Blog Talk Radio.
Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Is racism hurting you? On issues of race, are you unable to speak, think, and act with clarity and confidence? Are you tired of laughing when nothing is funny, smiling when you are not happy, agreeing when you really disagree? CounterRacism.com, you can learn specific strategies and techniques to counter the behaviors of the people who practice racism in all areas of activity. Using words correctly, following counter-racist logic, even counter-racist science projects designed to reveal what racism is, how it works, and how to counter it. The open source code writing format allows you to pick and choose from a variety of counter-racist suggestions so you can produce the code that works for you. Stop by counterracism.com today and help replace racism with justice.
That's counter-racism.com.
Greetings, Mr. Anderson here with iGrowYouGrow.biz, and I'm here today to tell you that the country is facing hard times. Wait a minute, you don't need me to tell you that the country is facing hard times and going in many directions. Well, let me offer you a direction that leads to food independence with iGrowYouGrow.biz, where we empower you to produce your produce and allow you to eat what you grow with confidence. Chemical-free vegetables, that nutrients that you can trust. So go right over to iGrowYouGrow.biz, investigate the movement, see what you think. We will help you get growing. We offer several instructional media platforms that inspire you and edify you on producing your produce. You can go to the YouTube channel and search iGrowYouGrow. That will lead you to all types of visual media. You can go to iTunes and search iGrowYouGrow, and that will give you all types of audio media. These are free resources. I also offer one-on-one garden coaching for only $10 an hour. It's the fall season, winter time. You may not think that you can start. Well, you can start getting your soil prep for the next season. You can get your intellectual properties of your mind prepared for the next season. So do yourself a favor and visit iGrowYouGrow.biz. Fare ye well, Mr. Anderson.
Greetings. This is the Counter Racist Evolving Engineer Program. The acronym for the program is CREE, C-R-E-E, and that is my handle. This evening's program will be hosted, again, by Loves Black Men, LBM for short. And this evening we are slated to talk with Mr. Sekou Olyinka about the house that Jopa built. Mr. Olyinka let me know that he's one of the few black males who has attended that infamous institution. Just one that just got caught. Just that had a bunch of people that got caught doing what I think the evidence is routine for white folks. And so we're back for, I think this is the third time we've gone over this subject matter. But Mr. Olyinka let me know via Facebook, of course. We were just having a conversation out on the block about what he said was a very incestuous environment there at Penn State, and that people would be amazed, he said, at how deep the rabbit hole went. So I just corresponded with him on Facebook about 4 minutes ago, right before the ads came on for this program, and he is waiting for my call. I'm going to have to dial him from the switchboard, so you're going to hear me, you'll hear it. The dial pad, but no worries.
Yes, I can kind of sort of hear you.
Oh, you're having a hard time hearing? Okay.
That's better. There you go. That's better. Before you sounded a little broken up, and now I can hear you pretty well.
Okay, let's make sure you can still hear me. Can you hear me now?
Yes, ma'am, I can. Thank you.
Beautiful. Okay, I want to make sure that you can hear my co-host as well. So, LBM, could you please greet the guests?
Say cool. Are you there?
I am.
Okay, I can hear you clearly.
Very
wonderful.
Good.
Thank you for your patience and your
yes.
understanding, because I haven't been as businesslike as I should have been, and it was not intentional, nor was it. I really did take this the subject matter seriously. It's just I've been, you know, negroed out, I suppose, this week, and I apologize for that.
Wow.
So, you know, we've traversed this territory before. And we have reached the conclusion that not only is what happened at Penn State normative for that institution, but it's normative for a whole lot of institutions where white people dominate, and it's normative for them generally. But, I mean, this thing goes deeper even than I knew based upon what I've heard a few people say, but I think what really piqued my interest is what you said on Facebook. You said, hey, I went there, and you would be amazed how deep the rabbit hole goes. So do tell.
Yes.
First of all, let me just give this in perspective. I attended Penn State from fall of 84 through the, let me make sure I get it right, spring of 90. One, that's when I left the campus. Now, there was a couple of semesters in between those two extremes where I actually wasn't enrolled in school, either for financial aid or, and actually one point during that time period, I came home because of some family issues that my family we were going through, so I came home to kind of stabilize. I'm the oldest of seven children, so I came home to kind of help out. But in any case, that gives you an idea. I was attending in 84 to about 91, so we're talking about 5 years ago when I was on the campus. And at the time when I went up there, we were part of the largest at that time influx of black students that Penn State had brought in to date. And that's because at the time the federal government was threatening to take away certain aid and certain monies from Penn State because they had not met certain quotas or requirements. I think they had to do with affirmative action or something that had come out of the civil rights era. And in response to that, Penn State brought in a lot of African-American students. And at the time, it was taken. Once I got up there, I didn't realize the full ramifications of that, but a lot of the there was a lot of bitterness on behalf of some of the white students that we found out later, not immediately, but over time, that we really didn't belong up there. Somehow or other, we didn't qualify. We really didn't belong. That Penn State was forced to bring in most of these black students, that we were subpar educationally, that we did not meet the requirements, and that basically we should be fortunate, or we should feel fortunate, that we were allowed to attend the campus, be on the campus. And this came out later on as I became a student activist in 1986, 87, and 88. There was a big sit-in in April of 88 at Pennsylvania State University. Myself and a number of other students sat in at the president's office. We wanted to talk to him at the time about recruitment and retention. We had been the largest African-American class coming in, but we had not fared well. A lot of us had falling out, dropped out, or whatever happened because of the atmosphere there was not supportive. So anyway, this is the kind of context I give you because my interaction with Penn State University and the atmosphere up there obviously wasn't from the football side of it. I was not a football player, but I did know just about all the black football players and a lot of the white football players, you know, and a lot of the other athletes up there. But I was more of a student activist, and I protested. I was arrested a couple times for trying to improve the atmosphere up there for black students in particular. So when I say I built the environment, we received everything from hate mail. We received death threats. We received our phones were tapped by the university.
Wow.
And that's another a whole other issue I can go into. We actually were at one point, the State Bureau of, I guess we call it the state version of Pennsylvania's FBI, was brought in to supposedly investigate racism on the campus and things like that. And it ended up, basically, they ended up investigating the student protesters. I got a lot of black students that, you know, say, cool, you know, these, you know, guys from the state were at my job on campus or wherever they were working at, in school, and they were asking questions about you, or I was told by my supervisor I was going to be interviewed by somebody from the state, and they were going to be asking questions about, you know, certain people and this, that, and the third, you know. And I was like, really? You know, that was really kind of shocking, since the public perception was that they were up on the campus to investigate racism and claims of racism and death threats and things like that to students on campus. So anyway, make a long story short, we got to see a side of Penn State that a lot of the black students didn't. You just went to class and went to the football games and went to the parties and things like that. You maybe were kind of immune from it, but when you pushed the envelope at Penn State, what was revealed to us over time was an atmosphere of one of, again, you all are outsiders. You should be fortunate that we even let you in our university. And now, never mind you, Pennsylvania State University is a state university. It's a quasi-state university. They do receive state funds. However, they're not required to report the actual budget of the university to the state elected officials. In other words, the Pennsylvania state senators and state representatives are not required to know or not required to receive a report of the actual budget for Pennsylvania State University for a long time up to today. No one ever knew what Joe Paterno made in terms of a salary. And that was one of our demands when we sat in on the buildings. Like, what is the budget for the state? How much money do you all get from the state? What is that money for? And they never, ever, to this day, have never released that. And no one has ever known what Joe Paterno made, for example, as a salary. So I say this to say that the environment, and I'm not saying Joe Paterno himself personally did this, but he is emblematic of an environment that was very, very insular. First of all, State College is a very difficult place to get to, especially 20, 25 years ago. It's a very difficult place to get to. And that, I believe, feeds into the environment. It's very insular, almost incestuous. If you look at, for example, the staff of the football team, those guys, those coaches there have been there 20, 25 years. Those guys were raised up in that program, and they've been here forever. So there's very little in the way of new ideas or outside ideas coming into that program. So when you look at it, even today, and you watch the memorial service with Joe Paterno, you kept hearing this idea of family. You know, Joe Paterno, once he became part of the Penn State football program, he was part of the family. And it's my submission that he ran the program much like a modern-day, you know, mafia don. Not to say there was anything criminal about him, but I'm saying in the manner of which we've come to associate the Godfather and other of those kind of Hollywood images is very much like a family and very much insular and very much looking out for their own best interests. And it doesn't surprise me that someone like Sandusky, who was a part of the family, he played for Joe Paterno. He was hired by Joe Paterno and later became a coach. And he was the architect of those great Penn State defenses. Penn State is known as linebacker university. And Jerry Sandusky was the main architect, if you will, of those great Penn State defenses of the 70s and 80s and 90s, and he put a lot of players in the pros. So he is, although not nearly as well known as Joe Paterno, he is highly regarded in that atmosphere and in that environment. He helped bring two national championships to Penn State. So, again, they look out for their own up there, and if you're an outsider, you were definitely made to feel that way.
Say cool. This is LB.
Yes, ma'am.
Can
yes.
you just help and give me an idea of the geography of this? You on the University Park campus?
Yes, ma'am, I was.
Okay, and that's the main campus, right?
That's the main campus. University Park is, the main campus.
Okay, so now what are we talking about? Is this close to Philly, or is this like out in the boonies?
State College is almost dead. It's almost dead center in the middle of the state. I'm literally about halfway east and west, and almost halfway north and south. It's almost dead center in the middle of the state. It sits up in the mountains, actually in a valley in the mountains. The Appalachian Mountain Chain. Happy Valley is part of that Appalachian Mountain Chain that runs down. It runs actually into northeastern Pennsylvania. We call that the Poconos. Actually, that mountain chain runs up into New York. It's known as the Adirondacks. But it's about 200 miles from Philadelphia.
Okay. So it's in there a bit. I'm in New York, so for me, I know Philly, and I know, you know, Lancaster and, you know, the Orange territory. So, okay, so we're going towards Ohio.
Yes, going west from Philadelphia towards Ohio. It's about 6 hours from the city, maybe 6.5 hours from New York City.
Okay, so, you know, my question concerning that is, what's the proximity of the university to the you know, these so-called places where these children from these broken families would be coming from? Where would those young people, where would they have been coming from? They would have to have been brought in, or is there an area close to there where, you know, there's some so-called inner city type of situation? I'm not understanding where these young people, where he brought these young people in from.
Right. Well, there's a couple of different answers to that question. It all depends on what program we're talking about. If you're talking about the Second Mile program, these were children that, again, could have been born from any number of environments. Philadelphia, Harrisburg, York, Pennsylvania, possibly. Certainly Pittsburgh and Erie and places like that. And then you also have, remember, Jerry Sandusky was a former football coach, so he would football camps and things like that run, so he would have access or bringing in kids, maybe not even from so-called inner city or impoverished environments. Some of these kids may have been coming from some of the, more fortunate areas of the state. And we still don't know how many of them came from out of state. I assume most of them came from in-state, but these are probably the areas where children would come from. And again, we still don't know the identity. I've been unable, through anybody that I know, to determine whether the primary number of kids who were molested were African-American or whether they were, you know, of European descent. I haven't been able to find that out. But the language that we see in print would tend to lend itself toward some of these young men being so-called minorities or African-American.
When you say the language, I think I know what you mean, but can you break that down for us? What kind of language are you talking about that tends to indicate that these were African-American or black children?
Well, in the articles that we see written, we're talking about children that were from impoverished background, disadvantaged. Words like that tend to be code words when we're speaking, you know, in America. These are code words for usually minorities, in other words, you'll hear used. Although that wasn't exactly used in this particular case, but these kinds of words, what I'm saying, tend to speak to African American or Latino youth. Generally speaking, we don't generally speak of disadvantaged white youth without saying disadvantaged white. Disadvantaged by itself, you know, usually means African American or Latino. So, in the back in November when the story first broke, these are the kinds of words that I was seeing in print, and immediately I became concerned that at least some of these victims may have been of African descent.
Absolutely. Let me backtrack. There is an association, at least to me and several people I know, there's a very close association between racism, white
mm-hmm.
supremacy, and sexual abuse of black people, in particular pedophilia and rape of black boys. That has been going on since at least the days of slavery in this part of the world. And so
mm-hmm.
for me, it's important, the context that you developed when you first started speaking is extremely important, because if you just look at a little, even a short time frame, historically speaking, you were there for a good while. I mean, you've got a good bird's eye view there. You were there for 6.5 years, beginning in about fall of 84, and that was, and you left in 91, and the tapes flying all over the web about Penn State and Joe Paterno in particular. May he not rest in peace at all. That's the story in the year of 2000 about him turning a blind eye to the racism, the explicit, violent, threatening kind of racism that was occurring. That was, you know, 9 years from the time that you were there. So you're talking about, this is really a 25-year march that they just happened to get caught in. And it sounds like you were really, really involved in some of the efforts there, a lot of the student politics there. And I'm wondering several things. I mean, because if I were a student there getting involved in those kind of things, as I had those those days as well, one of the things I would have wanted to ask is, why is this still a quasi-state institution? Why hasn't this been rechartered? Why hasn't legislation been written to make this really fully a state institution? And, when those kind of questions were asked, I'm wondering if you know whether or not they'd been asked and what kind of responses were given as to why these people were always given a loophole as to what they were doing. And it seems like they were a real protected sort of research and development organization out in the boonies, almost like some sort of almost espionage, R&D. They're supposed to be out in the boonies. They stayed there out, way out there from anything. They were never really, they were never scrutinized. They were never under the close supervision or even the authority of really anyone. While they were still getting taxpayer dollars, so I'm wondering if you recall that question being asked as to why they never were brought under full the full authority of the state legislature. What was the answer, if you can recall?
When I was an activist at Penn State, again, one of the things we asked for in our demands, we had a list of demands, and this is in the spring. This is in April of 1988, and we asked for access to, the budget, since Pennsylvania State University was, again, it's supposed to be a state university. And at that time, and in no time since, have I ever received an answer, anybody that I know that was a part of that received an answer as to why that information was not or could not be made public, seeing as though the money was coming from taxpayers. What I've learned since is that Pennsylvania State University is not the only university in the state that is quasi-state university. And I don't want to be wrong about, I won't name any other ones because I'm not 100% sure of which ones are, but I know there's about 6 or 7 universities in the state that do receive money from the state of Pennsylvania that are technically state universities, but they too are not necessarily required to reveal their budgets and things like that to state legislators or to the state citizens in general. And again, no one's ever been able to explain why. And like I said, even Joe Paterno, I mean, as a university employee, even his salary was never disclosed in all the days that he coached it. He never, ever disclosed what his salary was, and it was never disclosed by the university. And I find that to be, especially in this day and age, when everybody's salary, when a new coach signs a contract, everybody knows what they make. That's at private universities. Even private schools issue, they'll tell you what they signed the coach for. It's because they make the alumni and the board of directors, just for full disclosure purposes. But Joe Paterno somehow or other was able to skirt that rule. And again, I think that this is part of the environment up there. I think this is part of the culture. And it was just something that they got away with for so long that by the time people really started to get serious about the question, it was almost like a grandfather clause. Like, they never told it. And, we can't get them to tell it. And that's just the way it's going to be.
So, no, there was never really any pressure to do that, but you're saying that they were not unique. There are several others.
There's some other state universities in Pennsylvania that also receive state monies that are not necessarily required to reveal the extent of how much money they get or what their budget is or how much of the state money they use in their budget. And that came out in the days after the Sandusky scandal became public. That Pennsylvania State University was not unique, although it is probably the largest state university. It is the largest state university in Pennsylvania, and I do believe it does receive the most state funding. That much was revealed. They never revealed a number as to how much or what it's used for.
Okay. I just, while you were talking, and I was listening intently, but I just decided to be to look it up as well. And the only other one that I could definitely name is, I had no idea that University of Pennsylvania is also one, and that's an Ivy League institution. But apparently, he gets a level of funding that is that rivals an actual public university. Pennsylvania's a really interesting place because it has Philly, which is a high black population,
absolutely.
And that's a blue state. I mean, that's a blue city, not a blue state. Pennsylvania's real interesting, but also it has Pittsburgh, which
right.
Pittsburgh was touted by a former guest that I had, a guy that runs explicitly, well, he wouldn't say that he's explicitly racist, but he runs a blog called Stuff Black People Don't Like, which, you know, whereas he doesn't use the word racist, he uses every epithet and every kind of insult that is used by people like those that are in Stormfront and the Klan and whatnot. But he came on the program, and that was one of the reasons, those were one of the explanations he gave as to why it shouldn't be surprising that black people are in the situation they are, that we're not victims of racism, we're just somehow defective, and it could be demonstrated by comparing the city of Pittsburgh to the city of Detroit, that both of them were former steel mill places with a lot of heavy industry, but that Pittsburgh has a high population of white people, Detroit has a high population of black people, and that's why Pittsburgh never came up, because black people just can't seem to get it together. And I'm saying all that to say that there seems to be the state seems to be a place of contrast, I think, much more than any other state in the union that is not in the Deep South. And so I can see how it would be ripe for them to, just as LBM I think was alluding to, just go out and start hunting black children to rape. And I don't know what you've got, like somebody's got some sort of noise on the line with that. So I'm just asking you what the social environment was like, because you said that if you just went to parties and whatnot, you would never see it. But my remembrances of college, I don't know about anybody else's, but my remembrances of college was that it was an extremely color-coded place. And
absolutely. I mean, Penn State was, when I say you didn't notice it, I mean, I'm talking about you didn't, the viper didn't bear its fangs necessarily. If you just went to class, went to parties, you know, went to the football games and hung out, you know, you may have got a call occasionally, you know, you might have gotten called nigger, you know, by a passing car on what type, you drove down the street, you know, they drive down the street and they'll have to, you know, go home or go back to Africa or something like that. That might have happened once or twice while you were there. I think it happened to me my freshman year. I never heard it again. So it wasn't overtly racist unless, of course, you began to demand or you began to assert yourself in some kind of meaningful way, that somehow or other the treatment that you were receiving was not adequate. And again, our issue wasn't personal. It was one of recruitment and retention. We felt as though the atmosphere was not conducive for the retention of African students. It was one thing to bring us in for numbers so that you could receive certain federal monies. But if you didn't retain us, then what good was it? You know, we were just being used as a headcount to get a certain amount of dollars. And once those dollars were procured, then, you know, next year you would just get a new crop of black students, and you would not care whether or not they graduated or not. So we proposed some ideas, some things that we thought would help the university to retain the African students that they recruited to the campus. And that's when people like myself and some of the other student activists began to see the real underbelly. I wish I could remember the name. It was a very popular talk show up at Penn State. It was two white gentlemen that had this show. I can't remember their name. Very, very popular. And I remember during the time of our sit-ins and protests, the atmosphere became very, very charged and very, very, I wouldn't say volatile, but very charged. It was very, very tense up there for a while. And again, this is the first time in 88, and then we had another one in 89. But anyway, I think this is the one in 88. I remember listening to the talk show. We were one of the student leaders was invited on, and after he was interviewed, they went off, And their basic attitude was, again, you know, I don't know what they're complaining about. Half of them don't belong anywhere. They're inferior. You know, they don't have the grades. They denied some white kid a spot here, all because Pennsylvania State University had to satisfy the federal government. And now they have the nerve to be up here at our school, not a state school, but our school, and complaining about the university and how racist it is and how unfriendly and uninviting it is. And that was their mentality. That's basically what came out of their mouth. And I was sitting there laughing at myself, like, you got to be crazy. You know, I graduated high school after 3 years. I went to high school, and I graduated after 3 years. I did 4 years of work in 3 years. You know, I did very, very well on my SATs. I wrote well. I was initially when I came out of school, I wanted to be a chemistry major. I'm not a dumb kid. So, and my parents both were. My parents were both educators. You know, my aunts are educators. I'm from a family of educators. You know, and you all are going to generalize us to be this way. So I felt it just to say that when you pushed in that environment, you didn't go along with the prevailing thought process at Penn State University. You saw another side of it. And again, like I said, I call it the viper, you know, bearing the fang. And that's the side that I saw, and that's the side that I'll never forget.
Now, I was looking at an article that said, and I'm just, how did they manage this? My computer froze, but before it froze, I saw where, I think as recently as 2008, Penn State was ranked as the number 7 or in the top 10 public universities for black student graduation. That sounds like a big change since 91. I don't know if they're playing with the numbers, and I know that a lot of the things that a lot of what people tout is Joe Paterno's great legacy was that he had this high graduation rate of his athletes, his football players.
Yeah.
And so I guess I'm wondering if the numbers are so small there at Penn State, if the students are so small there, and that most of them tend to be athletes, and they're getting sort of tutored and pushed through the system, do you know what would explain the apparent discrepancy? Because I have no doubt that what you say is true, but I'm just wondering how it is that they ended up on this top 10 of black graduates list.
To be perfectly honest, I have no facts or idea how they've been able to pull that off, if in fact it is true, and again, I have no reason to doubt. What you said is true. Don't know. I'm actually, when you said it, you heard my reaction. I was very, very, very surprised to know that, you know, happy to know that, you know, the African students are going in and actually, you know, matriculating and graduating. That's a beautiful thing. I do know this much, though. After my time there, I knew that when I would go back to the university, I think for like 2 or 3 years, maybe 4 years after I left, I would go back and visit maybe once a year, once every other year. I haven't been back in, my Lord, I can't remember the last time I was back. I think it was in 99 I was back there, maybe 12, 13 years ago. But for a while there, I was going back, and I realized, I began to notice that the African students on the campus were not the same kind of African students when I was there. They tended to be a little bit more, and this is just my observation, no facts to this, but again, I trust my observation. They tended to be more suburban. They tended to be not as black or as I would say radical. They didn't tend to be as urban. Let me put it like that. They tend to be more of a suburban type of black person, and not that this is a bad thing, but again, the kind of, you know, the people who led the sit-ins and protests in my time, and again, 10 years later in 2000, I think it was 99 or 2000, it was another set of those blacks tended to be a little more urban, Philly, New York, Pittsburgh, D.C., places like that. We tended to be, you know, the vast majority of the African student population there. But I did notice that a lot of the kids began to come from little small towns and hamlets in Pennsylvania and Jersey and Delaware and New York and Ohio. And again, I think that this is a different kind of black person. They're used to being in the minority. They're used to kind of sort of how to get along in those kind of environments. They're not going to be as, they're not going to be as outspoken against treatment or against things that they don't think are wrong. You know, they know how to cope and how to deal with that, and they rock and roll with that.
And these were academic students rather than athletic students?
Yeah, these are the ones I was talking about, primarily the regular students. The African-American ball players came from everywhere, and they, you know, they came from all over the place. I mean, Pennsylvania State University is a national program, so there were guys up there, and I was there from Florida. There were guys there from, obviously, you know, Pennsylvania, Ohio. They you know, Jersey is a big state for Pennsylvania State University. Maryland is another big state they recruit from. But they had guys from Texas. They had guys from all over the place.
So, Sekou, in terms of the presence of black people on the campus, you said when you came in, because of a special situation, there was an influx.
Yes.
So by the time that you left, you know, and thereafter, would you say that presence maintained, or that there was less?
I would say maintained. It was we were the largest class in 84 that had come in. I think by the time I left, there was another class that had come in that was even larger than ours. But the number, while we were there, I'm not mistaken, my memory serves me correct, on campus at University Park, I don't think our population ever exceeded more than 3%. And we're talking about 40,000 plus kids going to the, you know, at that campus, if I'm not mistaken. So 3% is I think we had like about, I don't even know what the number, I think the number was like 1,000 something something kids on campus, something like, I can't remember all the details, but we never exceeded 3% of the campus population. And I would be willing to bet that today, although it may be increased, I don't think it's more than 5%. I'd be willing to bet on that.
Okay, so this is what I'm trying to understand. The way that I'm getting it, the football program, the presence of the football program at Penn State is like overwhelming. It's like everywhere. So,
oh yes.
And did they have their own cafeterias and, you know, they gyms or workout places where only they in other words, I'm trying to understand if a white guy is regularly having, say, a black kid or black kids, black children in the cafeteria, in the swimming pool area, at the Penn State Hotel, whatever, would it not be visibly noticeable?
No, you wouldn't see it. The Pennsylvania State University that I went to, again, they had their own private cafeteria. They had their own food. They had their own rules. I mean, for example, let me just give you a small thing. When we went to the cafeteria, you know, in the quad, we had to eat our food in the quad. We couldn't take, other than fruit, maybe a banana or an apple, you couldn't take any food out of the cafeteria. You had to eat what was there, and you had to leave your food there. Football players, they didn't have that rule. They ate, and some of those guys were, you know, they had to put on weight. They would send those guys home with doggy bags full of food, and their food was different than ours. They didn't eat the same quality food that we ate. And again, you know, these guys are football players. They're bringing in millions of dollars for the university, so nobody's going to protest about that or understand that. But the identity of the university has always centered around the excellence and the achievements of the football program. Pennsylvania State University is a football university. It football sets the culture and the pace. It's the reason why Penn State is on the map as a university. So those football players had their own cafeteria. They had their own, study facilities. They had their own football building, their own locker room, practice fields. Those places I never visited. I never went to the football, the building that Sandusky was accused of basically raping a 10-year-old boy. It was called the Lash Building. I don't even know if that existed when I was there, but if it didn't, I wouldn't know, because that was on another part of campus that you had no reason to go to unless you were on the football team. The only thing that Joe Paterno did insist on while I was there, and again, I assume it's still the same, was that he didn't want his players to have a football-only dormitory. He felt as though the kids, his football players, should be like normal students, and they should live in the various dormitories, at least their first 2 years. I think that was the rule. And then after that, their junior and senior years, they could move off campus if they so desired. But during the first 2 years, they stayed in the dorms. So when I was in the dorms as a freshman, several football players were in my dormitory, and I got to know those guys pretty well. So he didn't have special dormitories for the football players, but everything else they did separate. And the classes, obviously, they went to class with everybody else too. But everything else was separate. They didn't eat with anybody else.
Okay, so one of the things that some of the things that we were hearing in terms of what was making, you know, some of these young people feel special was that they were in the lunchroom with these football players. They were in the locker room with these football players, you know, on the sidelines, you know. But I'm saying in terms of on the campus, in terms of going to these lunchrooms, going to these locker rooms, going to the swimming pool, it would not have raised an eyebrow.
No, because nobody would have saw it other than the guys on the football team or the coaches. Most regular students didn't associate in those areas of the campus. We wouldn't even have known that there were kids with those guys or with the coaches or whomever because we weren't privy to that. We didn't go to those areas of the campus where the football players tended to dominate.
So it's possible that those people associated with the football program would have known and seen this regularly.
That's probably the only ones who would have known and seen it regularly, because that's the part, that part of campus where the football players practice and their locker rooms are and all their facilities are, only they go over there. Only the football players and the coaches and the people associated with that program are over there. Normal students generally don't go over there unless they have, you know, some kind of connection to the football program.
Okay.
Let me ask you about the social environment, because I'm trying to work my way back around to a couple of things. One is your experience of being eavesdropped upon by the state version of the FBI, I think I heard you say. But I'm trying to weave my way back around to this whole sex and racism thing. And you said, well, if you were just going there and you weren't pushing the envelope, you probably weren't going to meet any stiff opposition. I wish I hadn't used that word.
There's a lot of words we have to edit now for my speech because of this whole situation.
Absolutely. While you were there, and then when you came back and saw all these, you know, different kind of black students, those who had been raised probably around a lot of white folks, well, what I'm wondering is, what was the dating like for the black males there? Did you see a lot of black males with white females?
Very good question. I saw it, yeah. I saw it. And I saw it more amongst the athletes than I did amongst the regular student body. But there were some regular students, non-football players, non-athletes, who did date exclusively. You know, white girls or Asian girls, but mostly white girls. It was popular enough where you saw it, but it wasn't the norm. Most of the blacks on campus, most of the men on campus, pretty much dealt with the African American sisters on campus for the most part. But even if they did, you know, there was still some rendezvous with brothers and some of the white girls and all. And a lot of this happens, again, because at the frat parties, a lot of the frat parties that happen off campus, a lot of the football players are invited out to those parties, and a lot of the more popular blacks on campus get invited out. You get to know a guy who's part of a frat. He puts you on the list. And the only way to get to the frat party, at least when I was there, was you had to be on the list. And in order to get on the list, you had to know somebody in the fraternity. And certain fraternities were known for being, you know, party fraternities. So every weekend, you know, everybody wanted to go to their party. It was, you know, it was this place to be. So you had to get on the list and you had to know somebody in the frat. And that's really where a lot of the meetings happen, a lot of the rendezvous, you know, happen. Also, a lot of the football players are tutored, not privately, but they're tutored by other students. And that, too, is run privately. You don't really see that. They're tutored in another area and all. But a lot of those tutors I've heard over the years tended to be, you know, young white female students, and again, this also sets up an atmosphere where it becomes easier for these brothers to meet and date white girls and you know, get closer to the forbidden fruit, you know. So it wasn't like it today where interracial relationships even are promoted and even more accepted today. You know, back in the 80s, it still was kind of, you know, people stared at you when they saw you walking down the street holding a white girl's hand, you know, back in those days. You know, today, you know, he may or may not stand because it's becoming more publicly acceptable. But it did happen. It did occur. And not overwhelming numbers, but enough numbers. You know, the brothers didn't. Some of them did. Some of them flaunted it a little bit. And some of them didn't. But you knew that they had a thing for the white girls. And that was that.
So it was still pretty much foreboding. It was an environment that was not hospitable to that. And so
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying the environment wasn't hospitable. I'm saying amongst, as a subculture, the African American student as a subculture,
mm-hmm.
we made note, we kind of sort of took notes on who was dating who. Well, you know, what guys, what brothers like white girls exclusively, what brothers like sisters exclusively, what brothers like sisters but would go and creep with the white girls. And come, you know, we kind of sort of kept a registry amongst ourselves as a,
nice.
As a community of people. We knew how it was. It wasn't that the environment thing was, football players can do no wrong up there. If you're a black football player up there, and you, especially if you're playing, starting, and helping win games, they don't care. They don't care if you're
really?
A white girl. I don't care. They don't care. No.
Really?
You're a guy. I mean, you got to understand, this is Penn State. Football is, I think when I was talking to you online, I don't think, like, I was telling people, when the whole Sandusky thing, you don't understand, like, you got to be there to understand just how important to the psyche, how important to the self-concept of these people in State College and Happy Valley and University Park, how much football means. If you're a football player, I mean, you literally walk on air.
Wow.
Right.
It's deep. It really is deep. I can't even put into words just how he extolled and how he respected and prized these young men are, black and white. I mean, just if you're on the football team, it's like, man, you can do no wrong.
Okay, and yet, in 2000, it is said that the threats that came to the black athletes and to, I think, some black students generally, that
mm-hmm.
Joe Paterno were the biggest rash of these threatening letters, and they were death threats, would come after losses, football losses, and it was always some sort of undercurrent of a resentment because there was a black quarterback that year. So I guess. I'm still not seeing how football's trumping racism.
Well, again, that was in my time. That nothing like that ever occurred with the football players. I was familiar with that thing that happened in 2000 because again I was in touch with some of the students that were still up there, and I remember Joe Paterno's response to that was, "What do you want me to do? I'm just a football coach." So some of the black student activists at the time had gone to Joe Paterno and actually got a meeting with him, which is, you know, amazing in and of itself. You know, in my time, we never even thought to ask for a meeting with Joe Paterno. That was like asking Moses to come down off the mountain. We knew he wasn't going to be that for us, but I guess by 2000, you know, maybe getting, you know, mellowed a little bit or, you know, whatever happened. Maybe, and his situation was definitely a little bit more, the potential for violence was greater in 2000, I think, than in our situation in the late 80s and early 90s. But nevertheless, he responded with, "What do you want me to do? I'm the football coach," in a private meeting with the black students. And I know because a student who was at that meeting told me as much. But the fact of the matter remains is that the football players were threatening. There was at a time when they did have a black quarterback and Penn State wasn't doing well, although they, you know, had hit hard times yet, but they weren't doing well. But again, I think that was the exception rather than the rule. That, for the most part, those black football players up there, they don't know that they're black, you know, by the way people treat them up there. Because you put on that blue and white uniform, you're one of Joe's boys, they're going to leave you alone. It's almost like, you know, during slavery time, if you're walking in the town and white boys come to mess with you and you say either you're there on your master's business, they leave you alone because they don't want to deal with your master. So same thing here. As long as you one of Joe's boys, then you don't have to really worry about too much of nothing.
This is the Counter Racist Evolving Engineer Program. We're speaking this evening with Mr. Sekou Olayinka, who was a former student at Penn State between the years of 1984 and 91, and we're talking about all things racism, all things pedophilic, all things Penn State. If you have a question or a comment for our guests, the number here to dial is 347-633-9734. That number again, 347-633-9734. And I know that we have a couple of listeners who are well-versed in this and are football fanatics, I think, or followed very closely. I wouldn't say fanatics. So I hope that they will ask you some questions. Go ahead.
Okay, thanks. So Sekou, would you say that given this football fervor at Penn State, would you think that black athletes on this team could have seen some of these, you know, unsavory possibilities, and you know, just looked the other way or not really made a fuss of it? Do you think it would be that deep that you would not question why this older white male would be having these children with him? And he didn't have any children of his own.
Well, he did. He had six children. He adopted his children.
Right.
He adopted his children. And he was raised in an environment where his parents set up a house, and they took in a lot of children who were fostered a lot of children. So Jerry Sandusky grew up in an environment very much like that. His parents were foster parents. So children come in and out of his house all the time. And, again, I think this needs to be looked at. Is where did this man, I won't say learn the techniques of pedophilia as if it's some kind of profession, but did his upbringing play a role in this? You know what I mean? What you know, because he was around, there was a lot of non-related children, you know, boys and I assume girls that were around. I think his family converted a farmhouse or something and made it into a home, and he took in children who were wayward and so on and so forth, and that became his mother and father's mission in life, and they made a career, I guess you would say, out of you know, helping this so-called disadvantaged youth. And then Jerry Sandusky continues this as an adult himself and establishes the second mile and so on and so forth. But to answer your question specifically, would this football players and staff have seen Jerry Sandusky with little boys traveling with the team or around the practice facility and not thought that to be abnormal? Absolutely. They wouldn't have thought it to be abnormal because, again, that's Jerry Sandusky. That's what he does. He has the second mile. He's always done things for disadvantaged kids. He's always run football camps with them. So if you took one of those kids on the road, let's say to a road game or to a bowl game in another city, would that have seemed abnormal? Absolutely not. Would they have thought to question it? Absolutely not. They wouldn't question it. That's Jerry. That's what he does. He was above reproach. There was no reason to think that anything untoward was going on, given his, first of all, his godlike status as a Penn State football coach, and then second of all, just given his history of his family relative to fostering and adopting and helping to take care for so-called disadvantaged youth.
So my understanding is that there was talk, there was at the very least whispers going around the campus long before this thing, you know, came out as publicly as it has in recent times, that, you know, this has been years of this suspicion. So even upon that suspicion being there from years past, and this guy was still allowed to be seen with these children and without question.
Well, again, we have
the whispers had already been out for years.
Right, right. Well, again, we have to put all this thing into perspective. When I was at Penn State University, even when I left in 91, Sandusky was still on campus. He was still coaching with the team. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until 99 that he, quote-unquote, retired at the university after Joe Paterno supposedly told him at the time that he would never become head football coach at that time. I know there was another school. He was actually invited or recruited by other schools to come become their head football coach. But for whatever reason, if I'm not mistaken, I think Virginia, University of Virginia, wanted him, and for some reason, they backed off at the last minute. And I had my suspicions as to why they backed off. And I think because, again, the rumors were already out as early as 98, possibly before that. And, of course, we had the missing Pennsylvania prosecutor, Ray Gricar, who chose not to prosecute Jerry Sandusky, although he led the initial investigation into his, pedophilic behavior, not pedophilic behavior, definitely child molestation behavior early on. He's been missing now for a number of years. I can't remember when he disappeared, but I think he disappeared back in, I can't even remember now, I think 05, April of 05, he's been missing since then. So I saw that just to say that if you look at what was going on and you look at the timeline and everything and all that kind of stuff, were young boys around the program? Probably have been, again, because, again, you know, you have a chance to bring a kid who's so-called disadvantaged into a locker room and see a real, you know, a first-class NCAA football program and to meet Joe Paterno and to meet the various football players that they see on TV, nobody's going to think that's strange. These guys do that all the time. You know, they roll in kids in wheelchairs and kids who have leukemia and stuff. And, you know, it's almost that make-a-wish type of situation where kids get a chance to kind of meet their heroes. So that wouldn't seem strange to anybody up there at that time. But, again, after a while, the rumors had to begin to you know, surface. And I'm sure that people knew. And it's my suspicion that Joe Paterno, one of the reasons why Sandusky retired to death the official stories, because not that he knew that he wasn't going to become head coach one day. That was the good reason. I mean, the real reason was they were trying to separate him from the university because they knew of his sickness, his illness. And there's no other way to describe it other than that. He's sick. And they didn't want that to stain the program. Now, that said, they left it at that, and you know, he still had access to the university facilities. He still had a key. He still worked out at the university facilities. He was able to do all these things, and but he was no longer officially a coach, and I guess they felt that that was, you know, safe enough to protect the football program.
See, and those things, those are the things that makes me believe that he was absolutely not the only pedophile in the bunch.
I'll just say this, just to be fair, and I would tend to agree with you. In my heart and my head, something tells me that something else had to be going on, because it wasn't in anyone's best interest to protect him once people began to investigate him as far back as 98. The question I asked when this thing first happened is, how and why did so many people protect this man? What did he have on them, or were they in some way compromised where they really couldn't tell on him? You know what I'm saying to you? That it would lead me to believe,
right,
that either they were complicit in some things he'd done, or they were part of some sort of kind of hive or coven of pedophiles. I mean, there's been all sorts of rumors that have come out, and a lot of them have been written on the internet. So I'll repeat at least one of the ones I read on the internet where they said that, you know, that the whole Second Mile program, a lot of the donors to the Second Mile was Jerry Sandusky's charity he had set up for disadvantaged youth. That a lot of those people who donated to the Second Mile were pedophiles, and that was a source of those boys and women being pimped out to various donors at one point in time. And again, these are articles that I read on the internet, and you know, you have to ask that question: what was going on? How come no one in that whole program, at the risk of staining a program that people have given their entire lives to building, why wouldn't you have not only separated him from the university, but saw him, you know, prosecuting? What did he have on people? What did these people? What's going on there? That how are people compromised so that they wouldn't even do the right thing under the threat of what ultimately has come out to be the greatest scandal in the history of college sports? I mean, I just can't imagine why they would protect him like they did.
It's very hard to understand. It's very hard to understand. And as regards Jopa, I just don't see it. I don't see how this guy has been with you for darn near 40 years and is the architect of the part of your game. I think you said it was the defense that,
yes,
Penn State is famous for, that the,
yep,
kind of collaboration that would have been necessary. And the as you even said, the intimacy, the sort of blurred line between work and play, work and family that was going on at Penn State, particularly the football team, it would seem to me, I don't see how Paterno couldn't have been around him a lot socially and around people that he knew socially, they had, you know, they had common friends, common associates, common social acquaintances. I just don't see it. I don't see how Paterno didn't know. It just doesn't make any sense to me. And, of course, you know, we're saying, well, I don't see how he didn't know besides being told outright. I mean, that's ridiculous,
right,
what he did. But, I mean, how did he not know for all those years, for those decades? I'm sorry. I am not seeing it.
I think
seeing it. Go ahead.
I think that the rumors were there. I think that And again, I don't know Joe Paterno. I met him twice, you know, in passing on campus as a student. And you know, hey Joe, how you, you know, Coach Paterno, hey, how you doing? You know, how your classes? Both times I saw him, he always asked me how I was doing, how my classes were going, and that was just, you know, standard line. So I don't propose to know him. But I will say this: Jerry Sandusky and Joe Paterno had a very contentious, I mean, even though they were coaches, and Sandusky, if I'm not mistaken, played for Joe and later on coached for Joe. Sandusky and him had a kind of a contentious relationship. They really weren't buddy-buddy. That's not to say they didn't know each other. I'm not trying to say that, but they weren't buddy-buddy. That said, in Sandusky's autobiography or the book he wrote, I think he mentions Joe Paterno's name there like two times. Two times, and you know, so there definitely was no love lost between those two guys. Now, that said, it doesn't absolve Joe Paterno from not having done more than what he did. And I think that, I think that he realized, you know, at the end that he could have and should have, you know, done more. Why didn't he realize that sooner? Only he knows that. But he and Sandusky, matter of fact, one of the other things I heard from a couple people I know who were part of Penn State football team, who actually played on the team, and this is stuff they told me, you know, a while back, was Sandusky is one of the few guys that would tell, you know, Joe to go, you know, go F himself. You know what I mean? You know, basically, you deal with the offense, leave me alone, let me work my defense. And he was one of the few guys that actually could do that with Joe. You know, after Sandusky left, you know, guys that took over him, you know, really didn't have that kind of power or relationship or the ability to kind of keep Joe at arm's length, so to speak. So I assume that that's true, only because of the source that some of the people who told me that. But that Sandusky basically, you know, was you know, able to tell Joe, you know, basically, I'm running my defense. You go meddle around with the offense. But basically, you know, go after yourself. And so I say that to say they weren't terribly close. Now, that said, when you're working with a guy for 25, 30 years, whatever it is, you're around him, I don't care if you're close or not. You're going to find out or know or learn about some peccadilloes, some things. I mean, you can be around people in, you know, 4, 5, or 6 years, and you know the people that, you know, the guy is cheating on his wife, or the girl, or the woman that's, you know, who's an closet alcoholic, or the, you know, your neighbor that you know, likes to, you know, has a private swinger lifestyle on the week. You know, you find things happen. People talk. So it's my belief that if Joe didn't know outright what was going on, he had to have heard through the grapevine. It wasn't a secret. It was known before 1998, and I think that's why Mr. Sandusky retired in 1999, at really at the prime age for coaching. Coaches, by the time you're in your 50s, that's when you should have made to a head coach level by that point in time. So for him to retire and not keep the coach at any other university, you know, he actually was running around, I think, at a junior college, junior high, junior college or something, running around coaching there after having been at the height of height, the highest program you can get to, one of the highest you can get to is Penn State. That seems awful fishy to me.
Well, it seems to me that Sandusky was the one who had quite a bit of info on quite a few people.
It begs the question, what did he have on him where they felt compelled to protect him? That is a question that has been burning in my brain since this whole thing broke. Because you're talking about children here. I mean, I'm loyal to my friends. I'm loyal to my buddies, you know. But I'm a father, and I'm a man, you know, and I'm an African. And one thing in all three of those roles that I play is, you know, you got to protect your children. You got to protect your children. I mean, if we don't do that, then we're not even human beings. You know, you got to protect your children. And I'm the father of three adopted children. My children are all adopted, and I'm working on a fourth adoption right now. So I'm fostering one child, and I have three adopted children in my home. And, you know, this when the story broke, it really hit close to home for me, because I'm like, how could he? I mean, I have children in my house that aren't from my, you know, direct, you know, biological, you know, my DNA, but they're my children. And my God, I would do, and like I said, I love my wife, but I'm, and as Arthur Ashe said, I love my wife, he says, but I'm crazy about my daughter. And I would say the same thing. I love my wife, but I'm crazy about my children. And there's nothing I won't do to protect them and see them, you know, safe and healthy and strong and developing. So for him not to have followed up and see to it that something was done to see to it that Sandusky, if nothing else, didn't hurt any other children after he became aware is a blunder. It's a lapse of judgment that's unforgivable. It doesn't undo all the good things, all the lives that he touched in 61 years of coaching. And no, it doesn't, but
just
you got to question some things. Well, again, and you know what? I wouldn't disagree with you. If anybody feels that way, I wouldn't disagree with them. I would just say that, you know, it's almost like the argument they make about Dr. King and some of his peccadilloes. I always tell people, that doesn't undo what the goodness that the man did. So when it comes to Joe Paterno, I can agree with you only because it involves children. The children are helpless. If we don't help them as adults, they are almost totally without any resources to combat what they're up against. So if you take that stance, I would not disagree with you. I would not disagree with you. I would understand it, and I would support your right to have it. All I'll say is that I understand some of the, again, having gone to Penn State and knowing the impact beyond football that he had on the university and the things that he contributed to the university, it doesn't totally undo 61 years worth of work, but it damn sure puts a hell of a stain on it, and you never can talk about the 61 years of good without talking about this lapse of judgment that was absolutely horrendous.
And yet white folks are.
Say again? I'm sorry.
And yet white folks are already talking about the things, the good things, quote-unquote, that he did without bringing up.
Yeah, and they have the picture of him. There's a big mural of him with a halo on it up there at Penn State now. And no, he couldn't have been a saint. A saint would not allow children to be victimized like that if they knew anything about it. No. So I agree with you. They're already trying to repair and doctor and amend his image. You know, revisionist history is already underway about this man, and we can't let that slide. This has to be a part of the story. We have to talk about his role in this and what he could have done. I'm not saying he's the villain. He's not Jerry Sandusky. At least at this point, he's not Jerry Sandusky. And hopefully, it proves out that he had nothing to do with any of the molestation of the children. I don't think he did. What I am saying is that he is Joe Paterno. You see how powerful. I mean, if you look at the TV today in the last couple of days with this, you see how powerful. This is a football coach. And they got him. I mean, it's unbelievable the way they have turned out and all the people and how far they've come and all the. He had power beyond power. He could have stopped that thing with one phone call.
Right.
And had it been his grandchildren, he would have done something. He wouldn't have said it. Oh, I gave it to the police, and I just want to go back and coach the football. And had it been his grandson, his granddaughter being molested like that, Joe Paterno would have absolutely positively turned over every stone in Mount Nittany to see to it that justice was done. And he didn't do it for these kids. And that's a hell of a lapse of judgment. And you always have to answer for that.
He knew that he had more power than the president, than any president of that university. He knew he was the person, the single most powerful person at that university. He knew that when he told those black students after you, those activists, regarding the threats against their lives. He knew that he was the single most powerful person at that university when he said, "What do you want me to do? I'm a football
all
coach."
All he had to say was, "Look, all you had to do was go on the radio and do a public service announcement similar to the ones you see now where you have Shaquille O'Neal talking about, bullying and not making fun of people who are gay and stuff like that. All you have to do is go into a public service announcement saying, look, this is Penn State, this is Happy Valley, and we do not support or condone racism or threatening people's lives. I'm Joe Paterno, and I'm asking you, out of respect for me, to not only not threaten any of our students, but to welcome people and to make sure that we're all one happy family because family was one of his values. And boom, and Joe Paterno says that, believe you me, it's going to have an effect. He didn't even do that.
Yeah. I'm sure that would work. Go ahead, LBM.
Right. I think that even in terms of, you know, this so-called, godlike concern that Joe Paterno had for the students and for the young people, you know, I think that in terms of people actually seeing, certainly the guy who was the grad student at the time who became an assistant coach, who
Mike McCreary,
you know, supposedly walked into the shower and saw this situation. I feel very secure in thinking that young boy was a black boy, and that the thought was, you know, I'm not going to jeopardize my situation over that kid.
Again, I think you're right. I think that at the moment of time, he was a great assistant. I think he's definitely looking out for his future. And I think that he, at the same point in time, he's 28 years old. He's not a boy. He's a man. And initially they said he saw it and then he left. And then later on he admitted to say, I left, but I left after it had stopped. I made sure that it stopped first. I mean, I didn't put my hands on anybody, but I was there long enough where he stopped. And then I left, and he went to his father's house. And I'm like, I can understand going to get some counsel and everything and all, but you're a grown man, and you're 20 years old. I mean, I think, again, he's playing politics. He's understanding, my God, I just saw something that's absolutely heinous. This guy, Sandusky, is... If Joe Paterno is a god, then Jerry Sandusky is a demigod, and how do I handle this? So he goes and he tells Joe in certain language. He said that out of respect for Joe, he wasn't detailed about it, which, again, may have been a problem. Maybe he should have been detailed about it. Maybe it would put even more pressure on Joe to do the, not to do the right thing, but to do more. But he kind of sort of held back some of the graphic nature of what he'd seen, and Joe said he did the right thing, you know, and, you know, I'll handle it. And he took it from there and reported supposedly to his superiors, at least on the organizational chart. Joe Paterno didn't have any superiors. He had
right.
No superiors. On the organizational chart, he had an athletic director, and then he had the vice president of whatever it was. Like, I can't remember his name off the top of my head right now. But
the vice president of business affairs.
Right, and the university police fell under his responsibilities as the vice president. But that said, Joe Paterno was a man that every year walked into the Board of Trustees meeting and told them that he wasn't ready to retire, and they said, okay. So here's a man that's dictating to his so-called overseers, his bosses, when he was going to retire and under what terms, and they gave him that right. So Joe Paterno had no superiors. The university president couldn't fire Joe. He couldn't get rid of Joe Paterno. So even though he reported it to his figurative, you know, superiors, Joe Paterno could have ended that thing or at least gotten it addressed and looked into and stopped with a phone call. And nobody would have felt bad about it. But again, I believe he was protecting. On one hand, he was protecting football, his football program. And on the other hand, and this is, again, you have to have gone to Penn State to understand what I'm about to say. Part of the reason why Joe Paterno even told those black students, what do you want me to do, is that at the end of the day, all he wanted to do was coach football. He really did. And he understood it. And he would use his power and his influence where and how he wanted to use it. But if he didn't want to use it there, he didn't feel as though he had to, because his number one responsibility, his number one love was his family and his football team. So in addition to protecting the Penn State brand, it was just going to be something that would have drug him into a space or a place, but he didn't have any time or energy for that. Any involvement in this investigation for Sandusky, let's say had he done the right thing and brought attention to it, it would have taken him more and more away from his football program, and his attention would have been diverted. He wouldn't have been able to do the thing that he loved the most. So he felt good to be able to say, hey, I gave it to my superiors, let them handle it, and I can go back to doing what I do, which is coach football, which is true. I mean, the man was a football fanatic. That's what he lived his life for. He dedicated his entire life to a sport. I told my wife, I said, when I come back, if I ever get a chance to come back to the worldwide, I wanted to be able to donate my life to a sport. I just want to ride NASCARs 200 miles an hour, reckless like white boys do. I want to come back and just be a football coach for 60 years. And just, can you imagine just dedicating your life to a sport and being paid for it? It's amazing. I mean, it's almost unbelievable. It's unbelievable. So
the same way that it was a great cover for Sandusky, it could very well have been a great cover for Paterno as well.
How do you mean?
You know, this so-called total immersion in the football program, because, you know, again, I believe Sandusky knew as much about some other people as they knew about him.
Yeah.
Well, you know how they say, you know, the dinner thieves, you know, everybody kind of sort of, you know, everybody has something on everybody. You know, it's kind of like what happens out in Hollywood or happens in the music business. You know, you got to become a made guy.
Absolutely.
I've worked in the music business, and I have a brother who's out in Hollywood. And in order to get into those things, get those films made, you got to do some things that, you know, you got to do. And people know that you did them, and that's your past. You know, everybody's got something on everybody. Again, it's like, you know, getting into the mafia. You got to have a body, and everybody's got to know it. So So that way you got something on me, I got something on you. Now we can go and we can, you know, we can be thieves together. You know, we can be, you know, thieving brothers. But if you don't have, if I don't have anything on you, I can't trust you. So I think there's a lot of that is in, you know, that's involved in this particular program, you know, and what's going on up at Penn State. The other thing I'll say is this, and this is a little bit of a spiritual angle on it, not in a preachy way, but I think that, and my wife and I, we talked about this, you know, she's also, by the way, I keep referring to my wife, she's also a Penn State graduate. Matter of fact, we met in school and at Penn State, and so we're both Penn State graduates. So we've had a lot of, you know, we've both been talking about this because we both went to school there, and we met there, and all that good stuff. So, and she said, you know, all the things that keep saying about Joe and how good he was, and how much he helped people and how many men he developed, is perhaps God put him in that position because he knew that one day there was going to be this test. And that Joe, all the things that he stood for, and many ways he actually failed that test. All the things they say he stood for, in that moment when he became aware of what had happened to this young man and what was going on with Sandusky, that was his test. Everything that he had done for 50-some-odd years up to that point was preparation for what was going to become the biggest test of his life, and he failed. And when she put it to me like that, I said, wow, you know, a lot of times what we go through in life is not, in other words, God didn't put Joe Paterno on the planet to just win 409 football games and touch all the lives of thousands of, hundreds of thousands of football players and fans and people like that. God put Joe Paterno on the planet because he knew that one day, in 2002, there was going to be an incident, and Joe Paterno would learn of this incident, and the one person with the power, and it wasn't just an underling that found out about this thing or somebody who couldn't do anything about it, that there was going to be a guy that actually, when he found out about it, he actually had the power to make something happen. And God was going to make sure that Joe Paterno, in all his traverses, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and 90s, and into the 2000s, he would be the one in a position to actually be able to do the right thing and make, you know, have enough power and have enough clout to actually do it. And when he found out about it, he did nothing. And when she put it to me like that, I was like, wow, that is deep. That is really deep. He failed his final test. It's a lesson to all of us that everything that we're doing is preparing us for what's to come. And no matter how old you get, there's still tests. There's still, you know, challenges in life that we're going to be confronted with. And we have to be through and be consistent all the way through. And he fumbled the ball back, and it's a shame.
Do you have a response to that, LBM?
You know what, Cree? I'm really sorry because I did step away for 2 seconds.
That's okay, because I do. It's okay. I have a response to it. It's okay. Definitely see that as an important spiritual lesson. It's problematic for me for 2 reasons, Mr. Olienka.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I'm really enjoying this talk. The level of analysis that you're bringing to this discussion is far beyond what I expected. It's not like I expected you to be a dunce, but I didn't expect you to bring this much content, and I really thank you for doing that. And so I feel
no problem.
You can so clearly carry your weight and some. I feel like it's okay for me to have differences of opinion on things.
Absolutely. I welcome it.
Okay. The reason it's problematic for me is because the life lesson of one white man was
mm-hmm.
on the backs of many. We don't really even know how many black children.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's just that, to me, you know, to whatever extent you believe that there is a caring creator or caring powerful being,
mm-hmm.
that he would care, he or she would care so much more for the life lesson of one man, one person, over what is going to be the wreck of a life for all of those children who were abused is hard for me to stomach. I just can't. I choose not to believe that there is a God that operates in that fashion, especially vis-a-vis the way that we're taught to believe that God is white and that, you know, everything that white people do is valued so much more. So I have a problem with that, even though I do
okay.
see the value in that lesson in some other kind of way, but in this particular application of it, it's problematic for me in that way. And then I get back to the second reason, which is what, you know, I think that I just don't believe that that was the first time he knew. I just don't believe it. There were too many people being protected. There was too much to be protected. And like you said, everybody knows what everybody else is doing. That's the way white folks especially operate the world over. Mm-hmm. And that's the way the political system in Britain runs, on the little black book. And that's how they discipline their ranks, by knowing, mm-hmm. you know, what skeletons people have in their closets. So that Paterno didn't know is just not plausible to me. It just isn't. And just the fact that he wanted to stay away from it that much, I mean, I don't know. I have a hard time believing it came down to one moment. If anything, it's a series of moments that he was making, maybe millions of them, over, you know, minimum 10 years, but I'm saying 20 plus years. He knew. I just think he knew. I just don't see how he didn't know.
Well, on your second point, there's no disagreement. I think that Joe Paterno knew before 2002 what was going on. I think that's why he had to talk with him, and that's why Sandusky retired in 99. I think that Joe did know before 2002. So I agree with you, and I said that earlier. I thought that was what would happen. Now, as far as your first point, I think maybe you misunderstood the spiritual lesson. And the spiritual lesson in it wasn't for Joe Paterno. The spiritual lesson is that we learn from his mistake and what he did. In other words, in my tradition, and just for the record, I won't go into what I believe in or what I, but I'll just say this: I don't practice any of the major Western or Abrahamic religions. I never have. I was born into a more traditional type of situation, and it's really not even so much as a religion as much as it is just a way of life, a way of being that is based on sacrifice, is based on character, is based on reciprocity. Those are basic tenets of my tradition. But what we're saying is that life is difficult, and life is a series of tests. And no matter how, matter of fact, we believe in what we call, every 7 years, we say that every human being goes through a different set of tests. From the time you're born to you're seven, and then from 8, 7 to 14, 14 to 21, and so on down the line. And this 12-7-year test. And what we're saying is that, again, this is something that again, he failed the test. In other words, the lesson for us is that even though he is this icon, this mountain of a man as far as football and universities are concerned, he did all this good. He donated millions of dollars to the university. He created the Paternal Fellows. He touched the lives of hundreds of football players, if not thousands of football players, and they're going to touch the lives of many people. That said, and all the good things they said about him, he failed his biggest test. He failed his biggest test. In other words, all the stuff that he taught, in some ways, not only did he fail, let me say it, it makes him look like a hypocrite. If you believe in family that much, if you believe in young people, in the development of young people into men, then how could you possibly turn your back knowing that one of your former assistants, retired or not, is molesting boys on university property? So the lesson in that for us is, again, that even Joe Paterno, even the great, all the good he's done, he failed the test. He did not, in probably the biggest moment of his life, because ultimately this is going to be the defining moment in his legacy. Everybody from henceforth for the next 20, 30 years is going to talk about Joe Paterno and this scandal. And this scandal is going to mark it. And the reason why they're going to say it is because he failed. At the end of the day, all the good things, all the things that he talked about, winning, you know, the grand experiment at Penn State, which was winning with honor. He believed that it was possible to run a university program in the modern day world without scandal, without money being given to players. He called it the great experiment. And for 50 years, he was successful with that. 45 years successful with that. And in the moment, a human moment, a moment that didn't involve football players, it didn't involve football program directly, he failed 10-year-old, 11-year-old, and 14-year-old boys, and he didn't do enough to save them. And that's what I'm saying. There's a message in that, is that somehow or other, God gave him his test, and it reveals who you are. It reveals your character in the end. And Joe Paterno failed that test. And that's what I'm saying. It's not about anything else. It's not about one white man versus, you know, several of our young men or anything like that. is about the fact that he failed, and that we see what a person's true character is when they're up against an obstacle or difficulty that, you know, is not quite so stereotypical. When he had the chance, he didn't do what he was supposed to do. He didn't do enough. And for that, it'll be always a shame attached to his name for the rest of his life.
Do you feel like failed the test even before that? I feel like he failed the test in 2000 when he did nothing about the death threats.
Oh, absolutely. I'm saying he failed the test as far back as 98, when he finally first learned of it. At least in 98. And I'm saying at least in 98 because, again, the things I've read and heard, that it's possible that he knew even before 98. But we know by 98 he knows because at that time, Ray Grickar, the still missing prosecutor from Pennsylvania, had opened up an investigation on Sandusky. So we know by 98 he has to know. He has to know something is up with Sandusky by 98. So I'm going back into 98. I'm saying that Joe Paterno in 98, he failed. And everybody, all those children from 98 on it should have been on his conscience, as far as I'm concerned.
Now here's the thing. You have more faith in the creatures that...
For sure.
You're calling white people than you do.
For
because,
sure.
Because I'm of the opinion he failed no test. I'm of the opinion that he passed every test with flying colors, including passing his house on to his wife 4 months before the scandal broke. That he knew it, and I think he practiced the religion. You were talking about your religion. I think he was a fantastic adherent. He was a pious adherent to the religion of white supremacy. And he went out.
Absolutely. I mean, white supremacy, let's be clear. And I would disagree. I think that once we get to know each other a little bit better in conversation, and preferably maybe one day we can get a chance to meet, you'll learn that Baba Sikulang is no friend of Europeans or their history. I'm acutely aware of who they are and what they are, and I'm forever working every day toward, you know, righting that wrong and doing their thing to it, that young black children don't grow up believing in white supremacy and don't grow up falling victim or becoming adherents of white supremacy. Because, again, as much as white supremacy is white supremacy, African people believe in white supremacy, or else it wouldn't act the way we do. But we'll get back to that subject another time. But my point is that, yes, he was an absolute adherent to the religion, if you will, if you want to use that term, of white supremacy. Absolutely. How could he not be? How could he not be? I mean, everything in his life has made him who he is. In other words, white supremacy is like a fish being in water. The water is automatic. Nobody thinks about the normalcy of white supremacy. When you talk about someone, that can dance, you talk about Barisnikov. You talk about someone that has a nice body. You talk about Hercules. I mean, all of our, even African people, all of our icons, all the people that we look at, all the people that we use as standards, none of them look like us. Most Africans wouldn't tell you, that John Henry is my model of strength, or that the Williams brothers, is my model of a great dancer, not Barisnikov, you know what I mean? Or something like that. We don't use our own icons even in our daily speech. So white supremacy is just like the air. It's the default condition under which all of us live under. And Joe Paterno was no different. Joe Paterno absolutely was. You're right. He did. He transferred his health over to his wife. He made sure all his children set up. As a matter of fact, I believe that he went even further than that. I think that even his dying, I have issues with.
Oh, absolutely.
The way and how he died, how soon, how quick he died. You know, I think there's something to that. I think that he left his children with particularly his son Jay. I think he left them with any information they may need to protect themselves in his death, so that he can count his enemies, the people that might be trying to, you know, scapegoat him in death. So again, he did what he had to do. He knows his people well. He is a European. He has to know. He knows what they're capable of. So, yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't disagree with you on that at all.
I don't know what I can add to that.
Yeah. So Sekou, in terms of, this Penn State and then the Penn State basketball program, the local police force, the local papers, I mean, unless white folk were going to tell on white folk, then these young boys had absolutely no no chance, no protection, no one was there to look out for them in lieu of white folk telling on other white folk, which obviously didn't happen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, and they weren't going to tell. I mean, again, what's in it for them? For who? For what? Again, I already told you the mentality of that I gleaned when I was up there, which is you should be happy just even be up here in our midst, that we allow you into this environment, that you all know shouldn't be. I'm talking about this with the attitude toward the black students, and I don't think it's too much different than they would have towards so-called disadvantaged black youth. They probably have even more so of an attitude, that kind of attitude toward those young men. You all should be glad. You all should be happy that Jerry Sandusky even taking the time with you all. Do you all should be happy that we're letting you walk around in our locker room and meet Joe Paterno and lift the weights and run on the practice field and hit the tackling dummy and all those kind of things. Yeah, I think that level of arrogance up there. So no, and then if they find out something was going on or something untoward was happening, were they going to sacrifice their relationship with the Penn State program over some little disadvantaged, youth? Absolutely not. But who cares? For what? What's in it, what am I going to gain from that?
So let's take it a step further. Let's get away from Sandusky and Jopa. Mm-hmm. We've kind of talked about that before, but I mean, if white folks know white folk,
mm-hmm.
I don't know how familiar. There's a lot of stuff of Alex Jones that I don't agree with. I think he has a lot of distracting stuff that I don't agree with, but he has some stuff that, you eat the fish and spit out the bones. And one of the things that he said on a program right after the Sandusky scandal broke was that this is standard at every institution where there are a lot of children anywhere in this country. You can just go on the internet, you can find that it happened at the juvenile detention centers in Texas. All the juvenile detention centers throughout this whole part of the world that we call the United States, mm-hmm. All the major athletic programs where kids come in, this is just something. If they bring kids in to do paging for various legislative purposes in every state house up in Washington, D.C., this is just mm-hmm. standard protocol. Mm-hmm. You almost never will find – it's not that we don't find it once in a while. We did with Reverend Eddie Long. But even with him, those were older children. You almost mm-hmm. will never find a black person at some level of high authority that white people have let them ascend to. You almost will never find a scandal where they have been involved in serial pederasty. Mm-hmm. But you do find it with them. And so, I find it hard to say this isn't something that they know is just kind of standard for them. And if they do, then just average people knew probably what he was doing. Do you agree with that?
Let me say, who did he refer to before I answer that?
Oh, right.
Sandusky.
Yes. Sandusky and others. Because he was, obviously, he had a whole lot on a whole lot of people that had to be more than just, hey, I saw you steal some money. I can't see how there weren't a whole lot of people involved in this.
Well, let's break this down real quick. Let's look at the history. We're talking about a people that have glorified Greco-Roman civilization as the model for their society, this American Republic. And we know that the Greeks had a system of teaching, Socrates and Aristotle and Plato, these guys, and they were tutors, and that the relationship a lot of time between the mentor and mentee was one of the sexual ones. That a lot of these the mentees were actually wards of their mentors, and that there was homosexual relationships. It wasn't uncommon for even in Rome, where senators and men of high station and power to keep young boys on as pages and wards and actually interact with them sexually. So we're talking about a civilization now. This goes beyond just America. We're talking about a civilization of people that have normalized, if you will, homosexual behavior and the pedophilia that I think is almost concomitant with it. That said, did people know that Jerry Sandusky had these? Somebody had to know. And again, I think that I have to go find it. And when I do, I'll forward it to you via email or Facebook. The one that was saying about how some of these rich donors to Second Mile program were being paid back or being allowed to have sexual favors with some of these boys that were available through the Second Mile. That was one of the conditions upon which they gave some of the money they gave. So, if nothing else, that group of people knew who Jerry Sandusky was, and he knew who they were. And in that sense, what you say is absolutely possibly true. Again, we don't have proof of that yet, but I think if, again, people dig hard enough, and if we can actually get an independent investigation and nothing involved with anyone from the state of Pennsylvania, we may actually, you know, learn just how funky and how ugly, you know, this situation is.
Right, not to mention the wife.
Wow.
Well, again, another question. How, and again, some of the accusations against him were that these boys were being molested in the home. So how do you not know that? You know, I just
right.
don't, I mean, and this is going on for 20, you know, possibly 20 years, you know. So how do you not know? I mean, I don't know. I mean, and I don't know. I just find it impossible, you know, that she didn't have a hint that her husband was doing these things. I mean, usually men.
Well,
again, I'm no expert on it, but from what I've been told and what I've read and what I've learned about pedophiles, a lot of them have sexual dysfunction. You know, once that's their twist. So they don't even find normal relationships with a woman satisfying in any way anymore. So if she's not being satisfied, and you know, then you know, a lot of women I know. I mean, I know if I'm not satisfying my wife all of a sudden, she's gonna find like, oh, what's wrong with you? You know, she's gonna be more observant and start asking, you know, looking around and seeing if she sees some patterns or some things that are changing and reveal themselves. So for her to not know, again, I find that very hard to believe. Women are very, very even white women are very, very perceptive, especially when it comes to their men. And y'all know when we're doing dirt, and y'all know when we are, you know, thinking about doing dirt. So I'll just leave it at that. I think she definitely knew.
And the best, I think, best case example of that is the Bernie Fine situation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, they caught her. She knew all those years. It's not, how are you not going to know what's, you know, the rhythms of the way people walk around in your house. You know, you know the rhythms of expecting somebody to pop up on a certain common area in your house when somebody's been in an area of, you know, in the basement or in a back room too long. You just know you just know the feel of it, and you know when it keeps happening in a repetitive way. And like you said, you know when what happens behind your closed door has changed in concert with all this other strange behavior.
Absolutely.
Right, but again,
absolutely.
It, the question is, am I willing to risk my status as a major coach's wife for these particular young people? I don't think so.
And my lifestyle and all of the
right.
appurtenances and all of the perks that come with being this coach's wife? Absolutely
right.
not. For these little kids,
no.
I'll look the other way.
Right.
And especially if they're black on that team. I think... And I mean, Brady Fine's case, this guy was white, but the wife definitely knew because she, you know, they had her on the phone talking to the boy about being molested, so they know she knew. So she's really, as far as I'm concerned, she's as guilty as Bernie Fine is. But in his Penn State case, we haven't proven the fact that his wife knew, and I say proven in the sense of she hasn't admitted it. But that said, we all here in this conversation strongly believe that she definitely knew, you know, that her husband had an issue and definitely it wasn't with another woman. he liked little boys and I think that she knew and if she did, again, she wasn't going to risk her status as Jerry Sandusky's wife and all the perks that come with that and came with that over the years, and not going to risk the embarrassment. She's not going to risk, you know, embarrassing her children and all. No. Had it been a little white boys that he's messing with, maybe like that, you know, maybe not. But again, we'll see. I think In my heart of hearts, let me be also, I'm going to give you all another thing, too, real quick. When this thing first broke, I remember I just got back from Africa, and I flew in, and I came home, and one of the first things my wife says, you know, I know you haven't heard that there's something going on at Penn State, and it's supposed to break, you know, over the weekend or Monday or whenever it was. And I said, really, what's going on? She says, they're accusing Jerry Sandusky of this, that, and the third. When I first heard it, and I don't know why, my first image of the children that he was molesting were white boys. I do not know why. I just want to be honest with you. My first image was, and I think, in retrospect, looking back, I think the reason why I thought they were white is because the atmosphere up in Happy Valley, up in University Park, City College, is all white. I mean, you don't see young black boys walking around out there. You know what I mean? Definitely not during my time. That was, you know, you don't see young teenage black boys and prepubescent, you know, black boys and Latino boys walk around. It's just not the number up there. So my first thing was like, what? He was, I mean, I just couldn't. And then later on when I learned about the Second Mile and all the kids that were coming in, and then my picture in my mind began to change. Like, oh, my God. And, oh, Lord. He had access to our kids. You know what I mean? So it's going to be interesting to see just how many of these young men are of African descent, Latino descent, and of European descent. I'm really, really interested to know if we can ever find out, or when we find out, I'm really interested to know what the numbers were.
So do you think Penn State has that much sway even over the local and state media there that seem very reluctant to say exactly what the ethnicity of these boys is?
I don't think it has anything to do with that. I think it has to do with the fact that, well, I'll put it like this. They can hide behind the fact, they being the press, can hide behind the fact that these boys, at least at the time, were minors. And the fact that the grand jury investigation, that report didn't reveal the race of any of the young men. So I guess that, you know, they can hide behind that. I'm sure they can go do some investigative reporting and find out and, you know, determine that, and whether or not Penn State University has any bearing on whether or not they were to reveal that or not. I wouldn't put it past them. Penn State is a very, very influential institution in the state, very, very powerful. I mean, Penn State has the second largest alumni association of any university in the country.
Wow.
Right.
Wow.
Very, 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 very powerful school with people in a lot of powerful positions on Wall Street and in D.C. and in Harrisburg and all around the country. So could they exert that kind of pressure? I wouldn't put it past them.
Well, we know that they exerted the pressure on the law enforcement officials, if there's every evidence of that. Because there was the guy that was at the some sort of drug sting operation,
right,
that had overheard, that had taped or been eavesdropping on a conversation between one of the mothers and Sandusky, and mm-hmm. nothing ever came of that. They went to the university police, and all they said is don't shower with boys anymore. Nothing ever came of that.
Right.
This prosecutor, in all likelihood, met foul play. So we know if they could do that, it's quite easy, I think, to
Suppress
the media as well.
I won't put anything past them, believe you me. Like I said, I just, and it's very, again, the atmosphere up there is very, very insular and very, very incestuous. I mean, you saw that when Jay Sandusky first was released after he had been arrested. It became a light that the judge that released him on, you know, and he never even put up the bail.
I did not know that.
The judge that released him was involved with the Second
right.
Mile program. And everybody's like, oh, my
right.
God, like, everybody's angry that he got out, and then we find out the reason why he got out is because that's his hookup, that's his girl, you know, they're big buddies, you know what I mean? So it's insane. I mean, you be everybody. That's why I said, if you really want to get to the bottom of this, if you ever want to get to the bottom of it, it's going to have to be an independent investigation. It's going to have to come from the federal government, because everyone in the state of Pennsylvania, from the governor to the former president of the board of trustees, to the former that's another thing we haven't talked about. I believe a lot of the trustees knew.
Oh, for sure.
Prior.
Absolutely.
And they've escaped the public eye. And in that sense, this is another thing I'd like to explain to your listeners, is that Joe Paterno, and again, I'm not defending Joe Paterno, but I try to be as fair as I can be with dealing
as
with Yoruba.
As just
as I can be when dealing with Yoruba, I try to be that way because I have to be who I am, even though I know who they are. Joe Paterno was scapegoated in this whole thing, as far as he became the lightning rod for everything. They got rid of him, even the way they got rid of him. For the man had done all he did for that university, you don't fire a guy and tell him on the phone after, you know, 61 years. I mean, it just looked bad. But, again, these guys were running for cover. These guys being the board president, Steve Garvin, Rodney Erickson, even the governor. The governor of the state of Pennsylvania has to be looked at. He was the attorney general in 2009, reopened the investigation that Ray Rickard had started back in 1998. Then he goes and runs for office, and he accepts money from people that were associated with Second Mile, big money from them. Mm-hmm. But he becomes governor. He actually releases $3 million to the Second Mile so that they can purchase land or begin to erect a new building for their program. But in 2009, he'd already started investing. So why do you give him $3 million and accept money for your campaign when you're running for governor? You know, when in 2009, as the Attorney General of the state of Pennsylvania, you opened up an investigation against these people. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, this
it's racist.
You can't write this stuff. It's the old boy network and racism and white supremacy. All this are all intertwined. This is how they do things. This is who they are. And you're not going to get to the bottom of it with anybody in the state of Pennsylvania running any kind of investigation. Believe you me.
Let me ask you this. I agree with you. Yes, you're not going to get to the bottom of it having white people in Pennsylvania investigate other white people over pederasty. But if it can be that wide of a network, what makes the state of Pennsylvania so special? It probably isn't. It's probably everywhere where they are. So
I think
you're going to get to the bottom of it having white people who have all the power right now under this system of white domination. I don't know if you're ever going to get to the bottom of it having any white people investigate the thing, unless it is in their interest. We don't know, and that's what they did. You know, it's to contain. It's a containment strategy to keep us from realizing what their true nature is, possibly. It's just to say, we don't know how this happened. This guy was, obviously very sick, you know. And if they find another, they'll say, there's another?
Right. What is the thing, always? Whenever anything happens, there's always the lone wolf, there's always the crazy person. I mean, you know, whenever there's a school shooting, or somebody does something crazy, you know, this person is obviously crazy or insane. But if it keeps happening, then the question has to become is, well, how many crazy and insane people are out there? And are they really that crazy and insane? In other words, are these crazy and insane people the norm? You know,
right.
That's the question I have to ask myself. Is this the norm? Because it keeps happening, and it's happening everywhere. And I would agree with you. I think that at the end of the day, they're not going to tell themselves with so much. And I believe that. And I call them hives. I believe that these pedophilic hives are everywhere. They are linked up all around the world, and they know each other. They transmit, you know, messages back and forth to each other. They get together and do all sorts of kind of. And this is my belief. I can't quote unquote prove it, but this is my belief. I think that this thing is widespread. I think it goes back to their historic roots in Greece and Rome, and even before that, back into the caves and hills of Europe. I believe that this is just who these people are, and they're not going to be satisfied until they turn everybody into them.
No doubt. This is the Counter-Racist Evolving Engineer Program. We're speaking this evening with Mr. Sekou Olayinka, who is a former student, along with his wife, of Penn State University, one of the few black students who matriculated there. And we're discussing the continued fallout of Penn State and what its implications are for us in a global system of racism, white supremacy. We want to let you know that we're going to stop live streaming in 12 minutes. I don't know how much longer Mr. Olayinka has to spend with us this evening, but if you want to continue listening, you will no longer be able to listen on the live stream, but if you dial into our switchboard, you will be able to continue listening should we continue to broadcast at the end of the two-hour mark, and that number is 347-633-9734. Again, that number is 347-633-9734. We have four people on the switchboard, but apparently they're just very happy to listen. No one has raised their hand to say that they want to make a comment or ask you a question. But I mean, knowing the statistics of the way my program is run, that means nothing. We can have really huge numbers and people just still don't. Are just real happy to listen. So don't be offended that no one has asked a question or made a comment. But LB,
I'm enjoying the dialogue. That's fine.
You know what? Someone just raised their hand. So let's pick them up. If you are the caller at last four digits 2436, thank you for calling the Cree venue. Who are you?
Yes, can I be heard?
You can be heard loud and clear, sir.
Just give me a second. Let me just look at my earpiece here. Yes, can you hear me?
Can hear you loud and clear, sir.
Oh, okay. Greetings to everybody. Very constructive show. I'm trying to grab up my thoughts. I mean, it just kind of just goes back to what you and this LBM did on the Jerry Sandusky?
Jerry.
Oh, Jerry Sandusky, okay. Yeah, I mean, honestly, when I downloaded it and I went to the gym and I heard it, I would tell y'all, it was just so, I won't say even disturbing, it's nerve-wracking. Not even nerve-wracking, but it's, you know, it's just part of the culture, like you all call them, you call them creatures. But I remember what the gentleman, what you guys said about that, how they connect and whatnot. I would just want to say this, that's a form of communism, reason being, because whenever two white people get together and they communicate with each other, that's communism, because they're always in communion with each other. So you can't walk into a front of a group of white people and say, what's up? It's like, hey, who are you? We don't know you. It's like, they don't want to know you, don't even want to think about knowing you. But I just think that, you know, a whole bunch of non-white people who sit up here saying, you know, rest in peace, Joe Pa. I mean, I really don't know the dude personally, but I'm pretty sure he was in that ring. I would just say, I wouldn't even support it. I mean, for what? Just for another slave master in his gains for power. That's basically it. So I just want to say that, yeah, very constructive show, and I just wanted to I mean, there's so much I want to say. This is my first time by being on the program, but like I said, it's very constructive. And, yeah, just the information is just information.
Well, you said a mouthful, and mm-hmm. I really appreciate you phoning in, because you said something that I wanted to get feedback on, and I just totally agree. My husband and I were talking about it today. Actually, sir, if you give me a handle, I can call you something besides sir, but that's fine. And what's your handle, sir?
Oh, I don't have a handle. Just call me Avery. That's my name.
Okay,
Avery.
Oh yes, Avery. Okay, so Avery and Mr. Olienka were talking about this hive mentality, and you know, I find like it dawned on me today in a way that was so profound that I actually felt like I had been administered some sort of sedative. It gave me a calming effect that I really can't describe, and it's interesting that you use the word hive, because that was exactly the word that we used when my husband and I were talking this afternoon, that we came to the conclusion that after repeated experiences of seeing how white people who don't know one another and mm-hmm. have nothing personally to gain
mm-hmm.
by blocking the interests of a black person who is being mistreated or deceived by a white person who they don't even know, and for whom it would not be their interest their personal interest to protect, how without fail they consistently do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you look at the numbers of them relative to our numbers, it would have been impossible for them to have established this long-term domination if it was possible to get them to turn on one another for their own selfish individual best interests, because that would have been an easy thing to just operate. But it seems like when push comes to shove, they don't save themselves. They will save themselves if they can do it in some sort of way and also cover the collective hive of white people. But for them to so consistently do that, I have to come to the conclusion that it's an instinct. It's they don't even have self-preservation does not come before the collective well-being and dominance of their hive of white people. It's an instinct to mistreat us and to profit off of that mistreatment. I really believe it's at the DNA cellular level of their instinct. They don't have any control over it. I don't think that they're programmed to do it, and you can't even push them to put their own self-interest first. And, you know, when push comes to shove, they do what Joe Pa did, and they'll do it at younger ages. They don't want to, and the whole system is designed so that they don't have to put themselves in that kind of situation, so they don't have to take those kind of losses. But if they have to, they will, and it's completely biologically instinctual in them. I'm just inviting comment to see, because you said that you try to be just even towards Urugo, sir, Mr. Olienka. So I mm-hmm. offer that for critique.
Well,
Again, you said a mouthful. Both of you and what's his name, Avery?
Avery.
Yes, sir, I'm here.
Yes, yeah, you both said a mouthful. I'd say this. I don't think it's an instinct. I think that it has become a survival instinct, if you will. I think that Europeans are, because of their history, you know, coming from, you know, cold, mountainous, rugged environment in the Caucasian hills of Europe, so-called Europe, that they have developed a survival mechanism, and they also have a will to power, a will to dominate the people, the properties, the possessions, everything on the planet. And they, you know, first fought out amongst themselves, and then they turned outward to the rest of the world. I think that in dominating us, it becomes, you know, it's not personal. They want to dominate everybody. They want to dominate the entire planet. We are just, I think, the big, and Frank Crest Wilson talked about this, we're just the biggest threat to them biologically as far as the extinction is concerned, because of the nature of their genetics relative to our genetics as far as, you know, genetic expression. But I think that the Europeans are definitely, as Dr. Chancellor Williams said, they are definitely our implacable historical enemy. There's no doubting that. Whether or not they have an instinct to hurt and to dominate us and, alone, I would say that's for the entire world. I don't think the African has any friends on the planet. I would, not anybody. We're not even friends to ourselves. I don't think we have any friends on the planet. And the European is on top now because, again, he has to be in order to survive. He is a world minority. He is a world minority, and in order for him to survive, he has got to consolidate, at least when it comes to other peoples. And when it comes to themselves, and you've seen, you know, so-called World War One and World War Two, just how capable they are of killing even themselves, but never to the point where it threatens their ability to dominate the world. At some point, World War One ended and World War Two ended because at some point it became diminishing returns. We won't be able to dominate. Even if we win, it become a pyrrhic victory because we won't be strong enough to do what we really want to do, which is see which group of Europeans is going to set the stage and be the primary dominators of the world. And of course, after World War II, that mantle fell to the United States of America. So I think what you say is true, and the only thing I would disagree with is this idea of an instinct. I think that it's become a survival mechanism for them and a part of their culture and the way that they treat African people in particular, but really the rest of the people of the world. They could dominate the Chinese, believe you me, they will. You know, they can dominate and subordinate the Japanese and turn them into a slave-like people as they've done African people around the world. They will do that. You know, they're not partial to the dominating African people. That's my take on it.
Okay.
And not only that, can I just throw this in real quick, please?
You don't have to be quick, mm-hmm. sir. Take your time.
Oh, I'm sorry. I do apologize. But he said something else too that was kind of key as well. He did say the word consistent. I just want to add a little bit to that. Not only they're consistent, but it's all for their own convenience. Like the call says, and Mr. Ford said this repeatedly to all of his audience. I myself, personally, he says that. He did say convenience, but at the same time, it's like. Just give me a second. I just had a right on the tip of my tongue. But anyway, I was just saying, it's like, yeah, it's only for their own convenience. I mean, what better way to have a people who are subject to them convenient? I mean, it just goes back to that prison analogy he said himself. You know, so you walk into a prison, you know, get whatever you need, and walk out of the prison. You'll still be in prison. That's how convenient they are. So
right.
I mean, it's really nothing new, and so the reason why they communicate with each other is how they want to deal with us. It's like a civil war. Who's going to be taking control of non-white people? Even though the brother said Japanese, but you can't leave out the Latino descent people, and I'm beginning to see that happen like clearly. White identified. I was at a Mexican restaurant, you know, order some food or whatnot. I mean, even though I'm supposed to be going there, but I was hungry. I mean, hey, we all got to eat in order to serve them because, you know what I mean? They're not going to, I mean, if they stop feeding us, how are we going to be able to serve them? We'd be too weak. We'd be falling on the ground. I was watching this show on the Spanish channel, And it's a Spanish version of The Biggest Loser. And I looked at that. I'm like, are you serious right now? That's what I call white identification. It's like us. We want what they want. They want what they want. All the same price. But it's like, hey, that's what you call motivation when you look at TV. I call it what Dr. Francis Chris Watson called it, white supremacist programming. I call it, you know, what Public Enemy used to call it, turn off channel zero. That's what it is, channel zero. If you look at it, you flip through the channels, you just look like, damn, this is just white supremacist programming. But it's like, okay. I said, you know what? You know, say the cable network, this is all, it's all, you know, say white supremacist control. I say turn off channel zero. And I'm pretty sure y'all just sat back and just watched the whole candlelight visual of Joe Pa. Yeah, I saw a little bit. Then I turned the channel. I kind of saw the TV and I went on to my own business. Yeah, so of course I've seen white people crying and, you know, sniffling. Oh my God, I can't believe he's dead. And I'm pretty sure white people, I mean, I could be incorrect. I'm saying, you know how white people is when somebody dies, a part of their family, a part of their race, or whatnot. There has been some foul play. The little nigga snitched on them. Everyone want to get paid back for them. All we got to do is find them. Find the boy who he had sex with, and we'll find them. They will prosecute his family, have it out on the street within 24 hours. Now, if I'm incorrect in that saying, please correct me. I got to just throw that in. Consistently convenient. That's what I call it.
A well-oiled machine. That's what the system is.
A little bit too oiled. You say like that's like the mechanics of it. You got to keep that going. Keep that going. Keep that going. I was reading a blog of yours. What's that Negro's name? Something Patterson? Jesse Patterson or whatnot?
Oh, yes. I believe it is Patterson. You think?
Yeah.
Of,
Peterson.
You know what I'm talking about, right?
I do. I should go. It's, you know, I wrote the piece. I should know. But I know who you're talking about.
Yeah,
his first name is Reverend Jesse something.
Jesse. You got two Reverend Jessies. There's a Jackson and there's a Patterson.
It's Peterson.
Jesse Peterson. I remember you written a piece on that, saying that, you know what I'm saying, I guess he's supporting so-called Newt Gingrich, so-called, you know what I'm saying, running for the presidential rat race and all that stuff like that. He says, you know, young black children should be working as janitors. Oh, working as janitors. So you can have easy access to anal rape them, right?
Wow.
Wait, hold on a minute. Can you all just follow the logic there? Okay. All right. We're going to go ahead and hire this little man to be a janitor. So when I go in to janitor for a pee, I'll make sure he's ready for me. Hey, come here. I got a sucker for you. All right, now bend over.
No doubt that is exactly how it went. There's no doubt that that's exactly how it went during chattel slavery. No doubt whatsoever. And I think, Gus, on the context of white supremacy, which is the premier gold standard counter-racist programming on the planet, he said that yesterday, was that the, I think he quoted someone, that the demasculinization process is so critical to white supremacy that it cannot live without sexually abusing in a anti-sexual way, sometimes known as homosexual way, black boys. And so it's been going on since we got over here, since they took,
oh,
you know,
yeah, that's it. And it's going to continue. It is going to continue. So, you know, we can sit up here and trip all we want to about other black people being a part of the secret society and all that stuff. They doing a little bit of homosexual freaking behind that curtain while the white person's looking behind that curtain. It just kind of reminds me of the movie Saw, like they torture themselves to death. Even though he's not doing the killing, but here, I'm going to give you something to kill yourself. Because I don't want you on my planet. I control it. I don't want you here. I'll make sure that you're not here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put you into this little torture chamber, and let's see how you do. And I'm just going to be right behind the curtain. But the same thing with the secret society. I mean, it's all a bunch of homosexual activities going on. I was watching a YouTube video about the rap artist, you know what I'm saying? you know what I'm saying, being secretly, you know what I'm saying, homosexual, gay, however you want to call it. So it kind of makes all sense because everyone is like is down with that now. So you know what I'm saying, you all behind closed doors doing some homosexual things and whatnot. You come out acting all hard, talk about killing, you know, your own brothers and tipping your sisters and whatnot. I will say here again, before it said it best, the most impotent creature in the form of this person on this planet is a black male. And I will say sometimes a female too, period. No matter where on the planet they are, the most powerless person is a black male. And so forth and so forth. That kind of displays it all too. So is the black female. I would say all non-white people who kind of puts on this role that they're all hard or whatnot. It's like, seriously? Again, better be careful whose face you come into when you become into real trouble. What power you facing? They don't even realize it. So that's what keeps them blind, like zombies. Oh, it's like you can pop in an old school horror flick. It's walk zombies. I think I saw one day. Let me see what I got here. Well, yeah, I saw one the other night. I kind of did a little bit of experiment. Go ahead.
Let's invite the comment of the co-host or the guest. Mr. Olayinka, are you still with us?
I'm with you. I'm fine. Thank you.
Okay.
Stay cool.
No.
Okay. Have you gotten any sense, you know, from the people that you still know that are in that environment? Is there anything going on amongst the black students or the black faculty to actually discuss this matter and discuss? You know, because as far as I'm concerned, this is the nature of these creatures. This is the nature of these creatures. And I have a particular concern in terms of our young people going on to these college campuses and
absolutely.
And not understanding that.
Mm-hmm.
So do you know Grapevine or whatever, has this type of thing been discussed at least amongst, you know, the any number of black students there in terms of an awareness?
I talked to a friend yesterday who's still attending. He's getting his doctorate. He's getting his doctorate degree, and he's studying at the university. I talked to him yesterday on the phone, and as of right now, no. I think that right now, the environment on campus is one of, you know, mourning and definitely one of sympathy for Joe Paterno and all that's happened up till now. And I don't think it would be, even if they were planning to do or say something publicly, I don't think it would be wise to do or say anything other than what the majority of people want to hear anyway, because it just might not be good for your health right now. Especially if you're an African, but even if you're not of African descent, I think it would still be, you know, kind of dangerous to say anything, particularly up there in that environment. They have a very right now. Again, I've already said it 3-4 times. It's already again very insular, very very closed environment. And right now they have a siege mentality. They feel like the rest of the world, the rest of the country, press is besieging them, is attacking and excoriating Joe Paterno, and so they're circling the wagons, and they are definitely, you know, going to, you know, defend themselves. And if you're inside, again, if you're inside of that thing, if you're in that environment, they consider you better, you know, you better walk the walk and talk the talk in order to be a good soldier. So I don't think the black students, if they did say anything, I don't think it'd be anything counter that, you know, to what is being said now. I think they'd probably be better sort of saying nothing right now. But I mean, I get in touch with my buddy and keeping up with that because that's a very, very good question. And again, last thing I'll say, and I'll keep this short, is one of the things that really has bothered me, if you will, is the responses I have from my friends, former classmates on Facebook. I've read a lot of their comments since this whole thing has come out in November. And I don't know what school they went to, but again, it's just amazing, you know, how many of them are just, you know, we are Penn State, and, you know, yes, I'm talking even before Joe Paterno died. I mean, obviously I expect people
right.
to show respect, you know, when somebody dies. You don't talk bad about the dead. A lot of people are not going to do that. I understand that. But I'm very, very surprised by just the level of school spirit. You know, I'm talking about 30 and 40-year-old, you know, almost 50-year-old adults. And it's like, wow, you know, it's really, really amazing. I'm talking about black students who went there. And I'm like, you know, I have fond memories of Penn State, but only because of my experiences and the world that we were able to create, you know, up there, not because of Penn State in of itself, you know what I'm saying? It was an environment to be overcome and to be, you know, defended against. We had to create our own world within that world that became nurturing and self-sustaining for us who were up there. And to see people now just having drunk the Kool-Aid and basically, you know, they're bleeding blue and white is really kind of, I shouldn't say surprising, it's just disappointing, you know, and that's, you know, pretty much what I have to say about that.
I want to thank you, Mr. Olinka, for giving us 2 hours of your evening and certainly giving us the benefit of your very thoughtful discourse on these matters and, of course, your association there, your familiarity with the situation there. I hope at some point we'll get to hear your analysis again on a related matter and anything related to white supremacy. And if you want to leave us with some parting words, now is the time to do it.
Yeah, I'd like to thank you, one, for your co-host for having me, for inviting me on and giving me this opportunity. It's been very, very difficult, to say the least, to be able to express myself in a form where people can actually, if not agree, at least understand, you know, where I'm coming from. It's not difficult. I'm going to tell the truth the way I know it and be truthful, you know, to that. With that said, again, I'd like to thank you. I'd like to thank your co-hosts and your listeners for the opportunity. And, again, I'm just looking forward to seeing how this whole thing plays out and for the opportunity to speak on this and other things relative to white supremacy, because I run an independent African school. We've had a school since 2005. And so that's my day work. I work with, you know, young students. You know, it's a very small school, but we work with young students in African-centered educational environment. Independent, this is not a charter school. It's an independent African-owned school environment, not a charter school.
Wow.
Where are you?
In Philadelphia. I'm in Philadelphia.
Oh, excellent.
Oh, okay.
So this is what I do. And again, we've exchanged emails. I'll send you a link to the website.
Please.
Actually, you know what? Our website, it might be down. I know we're actually switching web hosts. We're going to another web host. But I'll still send you the link. It perhaps it's still up, and if it's not up, I'll alert you when it's back up. But we've been running the school since 2005, and we do a number of things here in Philadelphia. We have a real small, a maroon community. We're doing everything from home farming and composting educating our children. We're in the process of trying to create some other economic vehicles that will allow us to become more self-sufficient. So my whole life has been dedicated, since I was at Penn State, ironically. It was on Martin Luther King Day, ironically, in 1987, that I decided to dedicate my life to my people. I said that I would never, if I could help it, you know, work for, you know, anyone other than an African. If I couldn't do that, I would work for myself. And I said at that time that my life was going to be dedicated to raising my people up, and I wasn't going to try to do it by writing books and making speeches, but literally doing work to actually community build and build family. So, you know, we have a motto, which is reactionization, family development, nation building, and sovereignty. Those are the four tenets of our small community here in Philadelphia. So, you know, we don't necessarily see us defeating white supremacy as much as we see ourselves reestablishing African reality on the planet. If we do that, then white supremacy, by definition, has to be defeated. So we're fighting for African reality as much as other people, you know, would fight against the existence of white supremacy. And I think that both of them are necessary, but I'm on that other side of the coin as far as trying to build African reality. And I just, when you gave me the opportunity and I went to your website and saw what you, you know, what you're dedicated to, and I have the highest respect for you both. And just thank you very much, and keep doing what you do.
Hey, I had no idea. Let me extend an invitation. We could work out the dates later. I would love to have you back on and talk about what you're doing with the Maroon community and your African-centered school, your African school. I hope you will consider coming back to discuss that.
Anytime you want, you know, if I can fit into the schedule, you know, my wife was kind enough tonight to let me, you know, have to put the children down, let me stay up late. And, you know, even that, the adoption is part of it. We see ourselves as, you know, rescuing our children from being adopted by non-Africans. That is something that is not allowable. You know what I mean? We have to do more. So we're going to adopt as many as we can, and even if we can't afford them, we're going to still try to adopt them.
Wow.
Because we have to take care of our own children. We have to do it. So, you know, we adopted three. We're working on number four. And I'd like to do, you know, one or two more. I'm one of eight. My father, my mother had seven children, and my father had another. I was a younger brother. My father had late in his life, but it was eight of us. So, big family don't bother me. And I'm the oldest out of the seven that my mother had. My mother and father had seven together, and I'm the oldest out of that seven. So, you know, we see all of this again: the family development, the nation building, sovereignty, and the Africanization. It's all intermixed, and that's what we're trying to do. And all. So again, you asked me, and I did a little, you know, went to your website and did a little research, and I was like, okay, I can talk to them, man. They know what time it is.
Wow, I feel
Sekou.
Yes, go ahead.
Sekou, I'm in Philly often. I got a lot of good friends in Philly, and I am there often. I will be there next week. I'm going to get your info from Cree. And, you know, I would love to hook up with you, at least in terms of communicating, in terms of what's going on and supporting, you know, what you're doing there. But Philly is one of my second homes, so.
And New York is one of my second homes. I'm up here all
doing.
The time. My father's from Brooklyn, so I'm in BK all the time.
Okay.
Not as much as I used to be, but I'm up, because I have children now, but I'm up in New York a lot. And I feel very comfortable, particularly in Brooklyn and, of course, Harlem. But I spend more time in Brooklyn than I do in Manhattan.
All right.
It has been an absolute pleasure. I know more than I did, quite a bit more than I did before you came on the line, and we will definitely be in touch.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you very much.
You all take care. God
bless. Hello. Hello.
Okay, Mr. Sekou Olayinka. Wow. Very,
that's
very
excellent.
Oh, wow, very, very blessed. I think I will run Mr. Williams' commercial one more time, and then we'll come back and have a roundtable discussion. If any of the other folks want to join the conversation, just press that little one, and I will know when we come back from the break.
Is racism hurting you? On issues of race, are you unable to speak, think, and act with clarity and confidence? Are you tired of laughing when nothing is funny, smiling when you are not happy, agreeing when you really disagree? CounterRacism.com, you can learn specific strategies and techniques to counter the behaviors of the people who practice racism in all areas of activity. Using words correctly, following counter-racist logic, even counter-racist science projects designed to reveal what racism is, how it works, and how to counter it. The open source code writing format allows you to pick and choose from a variety of counter-racist suggestions so you can produce the code that works for you. Stop by counterracism.com today and help replace racism with justice.
That's counter-racism.com.
Well, LBM.
I am here. I thought that was excellent.
He was amazing. I did not expect him to bring it like that. I mean, I thought he would bring it. I wouldn't have invited him otherwise, but not like that. And then find out what else he's doing. You know,
right.
To have that kind of rich thought life and to have considered so many points of view, you have to have been, you really have to have been immersed in this work to have it at the ready like that. And I should not have been surprised at the end when he said that, because, you know, you drip this stuff when this is all you do. And he sounded like somebody who just, you know, he dripped it. So Very,
I'm feeling very privileged to have been a part of this. I'm a big fan, as you know, of independent black schools.
Right, right.
Huge fan. And so I will definitely be wanting to, you know, support him in any way that I can. And, I am often in Brooklyn, in Philly, so I would definitely be wanting to look him up in terms of what he's doing and what's going on. But, just a wealth of information that I had not expected. I hadn't expected to flow as
like that, yeah.
So well as it did. So that was great.
It was amazing. And for me, I mean, of course, I want to hear about the independent African school, but really just the logic of it. He's doing it. You know, Mr. Anderson, if I grow, you grow. And I meant to put on his new commercial. Forgot to upload it. But, I mean, he's doing the independent food production. And we can talk till we're blue in the face about getting out from under. But if we can't do the basics, I mean.
Exactly. You know, I mean, working on that self-sufficiency. And, you know, I mean, it's just, to me, it's just huge that we teach ourselves and teach our young people how to regard these creatures.
Right.
You know, it's just huge. And I mean, even to this day, you know, we're sending these young people out onto these campuses, you know, oftentimes in the middle of nowhere without the proper understanding of what they're going to be dealing with. It's a huge thing. It's a huge thing. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, we realized listening to Gus's program is that a lot of these creatures are now teaching so-called African studies courses.
Right.
And I mean, you have to prepare your young person going into that situation.
You know, that's definitely true. Yeah. Go ahead, sir.
I know that the both of you were talking, but I'll wait till you all finish. Okay, I'll wait.
No, I can always come back to this point, so I'll know exactly where I was. Go ahead, sir.
Very interesting concept. Sister LBM just pointed out, you know, to how we're dealing with creatures. Oh, yeah, I mean, you know, when you bring them out to the world, you know, saying naked, they're never going to know what's going on, because once they step in that classroom and they get, you know, saying sodomized mentally and sometimes physically, they kind of come back home quite identified. Trust me, I guarantee you, they're gonna look at the world now without looking at their condition in a white point of view. So, you know, yeah, of course we gotta, you know, say watch out for our seeds and whatnot, and that's another thing too. So, I mean, honestly, the people who have been white identified, I would say just basically black people. I'm in a area of the world called Las Vegas. Wait a minute, don't get it twisted. Oh my God, Vegas, please, don't get twisted. There is a little bit of culture out here, but it's not as culturified as you all in the East Coast. I mean, damn, I'm kind of thinking like that. I need to go out to Philly and New York. That's where it's actually happening at. But out here, I mean, yeah, it's a little bit of Afrocentric out here, but it's very limited. I said, for example, Black History, or I should say, so-called Black History is next month. I get to hold a little summit out in the high-class white hotels out here in the summit just for a day. Oh, yeah, sure, you can brag about your ancestors all day long. But when the day is over, get out of town. We don't want to hear nothing about you. Have you done a partying? You're tired or whatnot? I'm a splash of water on your face, and I got some work for you to do. That's how it works. So you can sit up here and do all your little bragging how great we are and whatnot, not even looking at the problem of white supremacy that is causing us to be at each other's throats daily. That's the basic procedure out here. So, you know, as far as education goes and whatnot, I mean, I just bear witness to Malcolm. Only a fool will let their enemy only a fool will let their enemies educate their children.
Right. Now
that's logical, is it not?
It is logical. It leads into what I was going to say, which has to do with being able to hold it in your mind that they are your enemy. That's a very mm-hmm. difficult thing for us to hold in our mind, and I think I understand why. I mean, LBM is familiar with my point of view on this, which is that It's very difficult to consistently hold that these creatures are our enemies as long as you perceive them to be basically of the same stock as you.
Right.
And that, I think
absolutely.
That's what is the, even the most intelligent of us, that's the one thing that is escaping us. And, you know, I think the reason that it's escaping us is because we are wired to understand how things work. And, you know, I know how this is going to sound, but I'm on the record on my blog. I have a name for them. I don't just call them creatures. I actually call them a name I coined. It's called oxyhominoids. And so the reason that it has escaped us that they are what they are is because we are hardwired to only consider the logic of what is on this planet. We understand the nature of things because of animals and people on this planet. But when you've got something that doesn't behave in those ways, you don't have any frame of reference for that. And I think that the biological evidence is that they are, in fact, alien. And that seems really far-fetched, but it's very simple, and I'll repeat what's on my blog. They have physical characteristics that are not adapted to this planet. They are not adapted to this planet in any way, which means that they could not possibly have evolved from us, because it's not selective genetics would not cause you to have something that makes you unadapted to the planet. In addition to that, they could not be a mutation, because the numbers of them that would have had to do these large genetic mutations in a short period of time in order for them to be able to mate with one another could not possibly have happened, knowing how rare these mutations are. If you're not a genetic mutation and you are not evolved in a slower mutated form, you cannot possibly be native to this planet. You have to be alien. Now, where they came from, I don't know. You know, I just realized by talking to someone I've met online, another person that involves themselves in counter-racism, I just met, as far-fetched as this may seem, it doesn't matter to me because I know where I'm going with it. I just met someone who made me aware, and I looked it up online, that I had an experience with an extraterrestrial when I was 18 years old. Several decades ago, but and the way that I can prove that I did is because for all of this time I have told everyone who's close to me that I saw this thing, and they're called tall whites, and I just thought it was the strangest thing to see walking at me this like 8 foot tall creature dressed in all whites, dressed most curiously in something that looked like a Klan outfit, and I just thought, I have been hearing my whole life living out in the desert that somewhere out in the desert, white people got together and, you know, that's where the Klan met. So I thought it could be them, but that's not what struck me. Yes, it was odd that they were in that clothing, but what was more odd to me was just that it was very dark, it was very cold, they were in a very light clothing, and there was no lighting along the road, and they were just incredibly tall. They were taller than any the tallest basketball player could be, 8 to 9 feet tall. And I told my sister that. I've told my husband that. They all knew this, but I had never heard anybody else mention anybody ever having seen something like this. And then just by happenstance, after I've come on the record about these oxyhominoids, I find out that this is a class of extraterrestrials that are called tall whites. Look it up. And when I looked it up, not only, you know, yes, this is what they look like. They're very tall. They're very thin. They have skin that is actually the shade of bond paper. It is actually white. They're very hierarchical in the way that they regard people here. Place and class matters. They look down on and mistreat those who are supposedly of a lower class, even of the people who are people here. In addition to that, you look at their clothing. They basically wear two or three different types of clothing, and one type of clothing they wear is a long flowing robe and a hood, which is what I saw. And you know, you can check with any of the people who know me very well, and they will tell you this is exactly what I described 20-something years ago. So more than that, but I'm not telling. Right. This is a reality. And I have said before that I thought that everybody on this planet, except for what we think of as black people, are hybrids of some alien type. And us. So the fact that we have problems with everybody and, you know, we have problems with white people, we have problems with everything in between, does not surprise me because they carry some of those genetics. Some of those creatures don't have, you know, it's a matter of varying degrees. You get an individual who has more or less or doesn't have that particular gene that codes for a particular type of behavior or instinct, then you're not going to have the problem with it. But a creature's behavior is a product mostly of instinct, habit built upon instinct, but instinct, yes. Okay? So I think that's why we've been missing it, because we have been basing logic on them having natures that are like ours.
Right.
And that while they may have some that are, if they're a mix, and you have to let science or empirical evidence guide you, which is that you can't say, well, all animals behave this way, all people behave this way, all whatever, they are what they are. All robots behave this way. If they're a mix of all those things, that's what they are. You take a look at them. Can I say that they don't behave in some ways that behave like people? No, I think they do. I think they clearly have some emotions that are like people. They're a mix, but they have some things that are different. They have some natures that are different. And one of the things that is just based on the evidence, is that they have a nature, I firmly believe this, they have a nature that is always going to be oppositional to us. It's a nature,
absolutely.
It's an instinct. It's an instinct, because you can't tell me that they can consistently, if they have to, put their own self-preservation at risk as an individual in order to protect the collective. That's got to be an instinct. You can't condition somebody to do that.
Indeed.
Go ahead, Avery.
Oh, no, I was just saying that I was agreeing to what Sister Cree had to say about hybrids and whatnot. But I'll let you speak, and I'll wait. Go ahead.
I absolutely agree with what you've just said. And that's why I like to concentrate on the anti-human element. Because, listen, four-legged creatures, they're animals, but they're not anti-human.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And I like to, particularly with, you know, the young people, you know, I come in contact with, again, in terms of how to regard these creatures. They are against you. They are against humanity. You know, and it really registered with me when Dr. Cambon was on, where he's saying, you know, these people are poor, you know, because in terms of what you just said, it's not even a matter of simple preservation. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because if you're poisoning the water and you're poisoning food and you're genetically modifying and you're creating seed that doesn't reproduce, that's anti-human.
Yeah.
And there's no reason for a human would not do that.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So it's not just a matter of preserving myself, preserving my species. It's like I am going to offensively do things to destroy humans.
That's their nature.
Right.
It's almost like that energy. That's their nature. But it's anti-human and anti-something. It's anti-earthling. I don't know if there's a planet for which that works.
Anti-earthling. Before you continue, Ms. Cree, I kind of developed a turn on my own perspective about this white guy, you know, that I guess I used to work with, and supposedly he's the so-called quote unquote date my aunt, and so whatever thing goes down, he just keeps hanging around. So when I told my grandmother this, she was in total agreement. I will call him, just like all other white people, schizo-necrophobic. Schizo means you're crazy. Necrophobic means you feed off dead people. Mm. So you got a whole bunch of dead Negroes walking around not realizing who they're looking at. That's how I perceive them. Schizo-necrophile. That's why I do that. Yeah, schizo-necrophile. Yeah, that's something I kind of made up myself, but it's like, okay, but damn, it's logical. You know, anti-human, anti-black, anti-this, anti-that. You know, it's like, see, Dr. Laila Africa
touched on this too. The reason why they act like they do because they don't trust nature. They don't trust each other. You know, when you be in the caves, you know, in the dark ages, no food, no water, you're freezing half to death, your family has no food to eat, you go out and eat animals out in the cold. It kind of reminds me of the movie 300, if you all seen that.
I haven't seen it, no.
No.
You haven't seen 300? How about you, just,
no.
LBM? Oh, you haven't seen it?
No. No, I have not.
I would say whenever you get a moment, you need to check out that movie. So-called
okay.
Romans, Spartans, and all of this stuff like that. I mean, they're just bestial by nature. Just bestial by nature. None of but a race of beasts. Like you say, poison the food, poison the water. You know, saying this is healthy for you, and which is not healthy. Then you go to the hospital, and then they're just ready to cut you up and feed the kidney to one of the elderly who needs a kidney or a heart or a leg or a lung or an artery. Well, they need something. Just take that nigger's heart. He doesn't have no use for it. They don't seem to have any heart anyway, even though they bow down to us. I mean, we give them education, we give them a job because they need to come to us. Who else are they going to go to? They can't go to each other.
Because we're in control of everything. Well, you can see them doing these things, but then it's just like what they do with they'll deplete a species, and then they'll bring it back.
Right.
Fuller calls it a God complex, and I would say that's descriptive to an extent, if that's what you think, you know, the Creator does. It seems to be their nature. Their nature, the thing that makes them so much different than us, is that they just like to manipulate species and the species that are native to a particular habitat. They like to manipulate habitats and the species native to them. And the more that they can do that, the more that they can disable the most basic instincts or the most basic characteristics of a species, like the more, the bigger high they get. That's just something that, it's like talking to them. It's like talking to the universe. You know, like you talk and you hear your voice and you get a response. Somebody might do something back to you. That's how you make your presence known, by you react with the environment. But that's how they make their presence known. That's why I call them very sharp, because they, in a sense, they do what we all do, is we have the environment react to us. But they really like getting to that. The more basic the instinct, especially like sexuality. You know, if you can distort sexuality, make a male into a female into a male, take children and make them sexual way before their time, and bonus points, make it anti-sexual too. All of that, and then after they go hog wild with that, I suppose that they will try to restore normal sexuality, just like they restore species that they have just about depleted. It's nonstop with them. And I think, you know, after that, that's something I'm sure of. After that, I'm entering into the realm of speculation, which is that if they happen to destroy a habitat that they depend upon before they can restore it, then they make preparations to leave, like a virus. And it's possible that they just go from planet to planet throughout the universe, like a virus, just destroying the host. And they get done playing with it, or they wreck it, they just go to another one. Find out how that works. What are their basic instincts? Play with that.
Yeah, you know, you went to the term basic instinct. The whole basic instinct is the area of sex. Now, see, like Gus said, like all the time, white people are phenomenal when it comes to that area. Like, you still see it now. I think it's being well enhanced, but it's a little bit decreasing now. The people I have in mind, I'll start with Miss Jennifer Lopez. You know, of course, she was so-called married, arranged marriage to a non-white person, which is Mark Anthony. So now they got a divorce. So now, let me just go ahead and just use the whole slave ship analysis. Okay. She divorced a non-white person. They both get locked up in chains with like me and you and us, the LBM. We're all locked up. Okay. White person comes down from the top of the slave ship on down to the hold of the slave ship. Miss Lopez requests an audience. Sir, can you I want to talk to the master for a second. I want to raise a deal. So of course, one of the captains of the ship unshackles her. Now, she's not coming back down to the hold of the slave ship with the rest of us. It's been like 5 or 10 minutes. She's still up there. Damn, what's going on? You know why? I tend to believe that she's up there shacking up with a white person. I mean, it makes sense, don't it? No, this is how I look at all non-white people. I feel like this. I tell them like this. I tell them this all the time, including black people. They say, hey, listen, brother, sister, you know what? You request an audience with a white person, and you're not back in 5 or 10 minutes, we already know that you've been had already. You already know that. You have been had. You know why you didn't come back down? Because he came at you sideways. Listen, I won't do anything. I don't want to come back down. It's hell down there. My own sisters won't look at me. My own brothers won't look at me. It stinks down there. Roaches is crawling over me. Rats and all those little things, they're just crawling all over me. I just can't take no more. Can I just please stay up here? The air is clean up here. I don't want to go back down there. All right. So you want to come up here and hang with the boys, huh? Okay. Well, you know what you got to have to do in order for you to smell this air. Well, what I got to do? I'll do anything. Well, here's the procedure.
Right.
You're going to be watching this deck for 10 days. After 10 days, you're going to get promoted to come to my bathroom and give me a nice bath. You're going to be washing my hair, my back, whatever I tell you to wash. Now, if you do this correctly, you won't have to be washing no more because you'll be in bed with me. That's the prize. Now, what do you say? Sure, I'll do it.
Hmm.
Five or 10 minutes. We haven't heard from him. He or she is up there watching the deck. If not washing his deck, he or she's washing his or her hair. Then washing the hair, washing the back. Now washing his back, washing his feet. Not washing his feet, he or she is washing something. Now let's go to the seal. Now I don't know how deep y'all be inside the tabloids and whatnot, but I guess Heidi Klum is going to divorce his slave with his seal. I think it's a whole controversy. They're about to get a divorce. Well, you know why? This is crazy. You know why? Because I guess she saw somebody that looks like her, and she wants to be part of that world again and not be sat upon and ridiculed upon. See? You know, that happens all the time. Tiger Woods. Who else is on the list? There's so many people on the list right now.
I believe Kobe Bryant's on that list. I don't believe his wife was not white. I think his wife was white.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Now the new dude that Jennifer Lopez is messing with, I think I've seen him in the magazine. I suspect he could be a white person.
I haven't seen. I didn't know she was messing with someone. I don't know.
She was messing with someone?
Yeah, you know. Okay, you know, it's like, damn, okay. Jennifer Lopez requested artists and a slave master to smell the fresh air. Now she's all over pressed over American Idol. Like a damn fool. Excuse me. Okay, that's not part of the call, that name calling, but I'm just saying it's ridiculous. This is what all non-white people do when they just can't take their condition. Not much longer. I'm living in hell. My money's going low. And
I'm glad that you brought that up. I'm glad that you brought that up because I had wanted to address this on a previous episode. And that this is the whole issue of you brought it up is the whole issue of agents, about getting rid of the agents so we can progress.
Right.
No, I'm not gonna. The problem with that is that as long as we're in the prison, you can't stop the creation of agents. It's just going to be like the roaches will just come back because you just described the syndrome, sir, Avery. Is you're in a cage and the people with power can just come and can make the circumstances even worse than the average prisoner. And and then once they've done that, they can then offer you a way out. And, you know, 900 999,000 out of a million, you know, something like that, are going to go for the deal. You, as long as you're in the prison, you're under their domination, there's no way to escape the creation and manufacturing of so-called agents.
Right. Cree?
Yes.
Since Avery brought up the seal clume thing, I sent you a, I forwarded you an email from the Huffington Post.
You did? Okay.
Yeah, oh God.
Recently? One that I hadn't already responded to?
No, I just sent it, as a matter of fact.
Okay. Go ahead.
But it's quite interesting. It's a picture of when the two of them dressed up as apes.
Oh, that one. Yeah. I thought you already sent that one.
No, no. But in the content of this article, it says...
this is a different photo.
Yeah.
You say, watch it.
Look at... Are you seeing it?
I'm looking right at it, yes.
Are you seeing it? Okay, look at the second paragraph, okay?
And they ask her,
apparently, not him. They ask her about the costume, and she said, you see that? Even they put it in quotes, that she was the link between man and ape.
Oh, I don't see that. Wait a minute.
Pick that up.
It's not in the second paragraph. What? No. Oh, yes. Yes. Yes.
She is a link between man and ape. Wow. Can we get, let's follow the logic. It kind of goes back to the missing link, right? Man and ape.
That she is the link.
Wow.
Oh, she's the link. She's a link.
Whoa.
In other words, I guess she's the epitome of what an ape is. Hey, I got this ape on my arm wearing this costume because I made him do it.
Wow.
I made this ape put on this ape uniform.
And I couldn't even believe that he had the total lack of consciousness even to do that. But, you know, when you watch him, you can see that he's not in any kind of right mind.
Yeah, you can.
Dealing with
her. Oh, no, he's not.
But
he
is not. She actually said that she was the link. She didn't say he was the link or we are the link, you know, or we were trying to portray the link. She said she was the link between man and ape.
Wow.
Link of power, link of control, link to tell you what the hell I tell you to. If I say put on this costume, you're going to put it on. If I tell you to wear my nightgown to bed, you're going to put it on like I tell you, or else you're not going to get any of this
white.
Well,
he does do the nail polish thing. I don't know what that's all about.
Oh, he does. Look at the last paragraph as well. That's interesting. The Project Runway's host celebrations kicked off Saturday in Las Vegas, where Clume arrived on a gurney and then revealed her cadaver costume, a bodysuit painted like the human body without skin.
Damn.
That's that necrophilia, right?
It's also very close to skin that almost has no purpose, meaning you have no melanin in it. So it's
no skin.
Right. That's the other. Yeah. You know, that's the greatest extreme of it. It's interesting. That's interesting. But she actually said that. She knew she was taking a dig at him. That those are the kind of digs they take.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. It's like an auction. If you look at it, it's like ain't nothing but an auction.
And he did nothing. And that's the thing. He didn't divorce her. He didn't. I don't know if he bristled. Who knows? You know, and you really don't know what this divorce is about. It could be she's just tired of him, period. But it could also be that he started to object
a bit.
See,
that she was subhuman.
He may have started to object a bit, and that started to resist, and he got to be an unmanageable creature, an unmanageable pet. And so she's just, okay, I'll find another.
But you know what?
And listen,
you know
what? That's very, very, very plausible, because that's exactly what they do.
I can tell you from experience that's what they do.
Can I just say this? Hey, you know what? We're never going to survive. Oh, yes. We get a little crazy. Can I repeat that? Can I come again? We're never going to survive. Oh, yes. You get a little crazy.
Wow.
And so it might be a two-sided story of that so-called divorce. Now, I kind of told brothers this, hey, listen, you break up with that white woman, do not contact her whatsoever. Don't show up to her job. Delete all kind of contact from her. Reason being, because if you keep on leaning, you know how white people do. She's gonna look at that as stalking and harassing.
Oh, for sure. Wait a minute. I need to say this for the record. For the younger listeners, what Avery was referring to was a lyric in one of Seal's hits. We're never going to survive unless we get a little crazy. So, anyways, look it up. I could actually sing much better than that, but not tonight. Okay, so go ahead.
Avery.
Yes, ma'am.
Avery, let me ask you this. If, from what I understand, he has been with white females prior to her. Apparently models as well, you know, whatever it was he was doing back in England. But what do you think the dynamics would be if he attempted to have a relationship with a black woman now?
Well, the results would be, you say, with the results, I mean?
What would be some of the dynamics that they would have to deal with in the relationship? My personal piece with this is that I would never go out with a black guy that had been with a white woman. Me personally, not knowing.
Oh, I guarantee that, and there's a reason for that. Now, I think this is code too. You get involved with a non-white person, especially towards the ones who look like you. You need to cleanse yourself mentally and physically. You come in the presence of a black female, you need to clean yourself. Don't even think about having sex. I mean, damn, you were just so drowned in a cesspool with that white female. I mean, you already know how white females is. They get around anyway. So don't sit up and bring all those venereal diseases to a black female. That's incorrect. Cleanse yourself mentally and physically. No sex with her. You know, have an understanding. I mean, any kind of grievances you want to, spill out or whatnot, make sure she listens. And therefore, she can give you, like, some sort of a suggestion. Like, hey, you know what? You know she didn't do that in the first place, but you know what? I want to work with you. And so we just go ahead and just build a relationship. And he needs to tell her, hey, you know what? I will not have sex with you until I'm cleansed. It will take me 90 days, maybe a whole year, but I'm not going to have sex with you.
It takes longer than that. Well, somebody's going to... Wait. You know, I have the utmost admiration for your point of view. You do not have to agree with me even on the most important things, Elvia. But since it is my program and I am someone who was so victimized, I do have to respond, which is that I totally understand your point of view. if I were in your situation... I would have a similar point of view. In fact, I do have one, which is that, but I don't completely to say that they're irredeemable.
No. I didn't say they were irredeemable.
Well,
right.
But that's very close. I mean, why would you make such a decision?
Would not.
Why would you make such a decision for yourself unless you thought it was impossible for them to be rendered back to the state that they were before that had ever happened? Unless you've concluded that it is highly unlikely or impossible, why would you even make that decision for yourself? So it is basically saying that you find them probably irredeemable. And now where's my logic off?
No, I mean I don't even mind if one says that about me personally. But what I'm saying is I wouldn't even want that anywhere in my history.
Right.
Why?
I totally agree with that.
So it's not necessarily that the person is irredeemable. But I would not want that in my history.
How's that in your – well, I said what I have to say about it, you know.
You pass that from generation to generation.
Well, we have about 5 minutes left, so I think we better definitely promo our next episode, which we're doing together, which is a week from today. What's the date on that? Yes, that will be February 3rd, Thursday, at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Pacific. We will be discussing, again and in more depth, the question of...
Is that the 3rd or 2nd? Is that Thursday?
It's Thursday,
Thursday, right?
Yes, Thursday. It's the 3rd, isn't it?
Let me check. Yeah, it's something like a Thursday?
Next month,
Oh, you're right. It is a 2nd.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
correction. February 2nd, Thursday, again, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Pacific. Okay. So we'll be discussing again, but in more depth, and centrally focusing on, do you want to create? Do you want to be crystal black? You know, exactly what is the issue with color, with you personally? And to make sure that we prompt honesty, LBM and I have agreed to be forthcoming ourselves. So, we want to encourage honesty.
Yes.
Okay. Well,
I'm looking forward to that.
Final words, LBM, Avery, and then LBM. We've got about 3 minutes left.
I thought the conversation with Sekou was very, very constructive. The post conversation was constructive, and I appreciate you very much, Cree. Thank you, Avery, for hanging in with us.
Thank you. And I like to say thank you, Ms. LBM, or should I say Sister LBM, Mrs. Cree, for having me. Even though I'm a bit rusty on phone shows, but I'm steady getting the feel of it, because I feel like, you know, this is a place where I can express my views, you know, negative, positive, just whatever that comes to mind that needs to be expressed. And so this should be the program that I would say not this program alone, but I'm pretty sure it does this program as well. Wait, before I get to you, Cree?
Yes.
Do you still talk to Gus?
I we correspond here and there. We're not on any bad terms, no.
Oh, okay. I was looking for him on Blog Tech Radio. I was like, oh my God, the white supremacist, got him.
He's changed venue. He's had to leave. They kicked him off. Yes, they kicked him off of Blog Talk Radio. They said they didn't want his money anymore, and they gave him back his money and told him to go away, and told him he was all horrible things, including the illogical label of racist. And so you can now find him on TalkShoe. So you just Google that,
okay.
And you'll even be able to find the archives. But he's on TalkShoe. Yeah.
Okay. I'll look for that. And this should be, you know, I remember Cree saying this yourself. I mean, you know, a lot of people like to talk, but afraid to talk. Again, I'm a bit rusty, but I hope that in future you'll allow me back on any programs that you have placed. So.
Oh, happily.
I mean, again, I'm like speechless right now because I kind of expressed what I had to say about certain things, and. I would just say, you know what I'm saying, for the listeners out there, hey, listen, if you watch TV, just go by what Dr. Francis Chris Watson's logic. Just call the TV in your household, wherever you're at, white supremacist programming. In other words, turn off channel 0. And that's all I have to say. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for calling in. I'm extremely appreciative.
Yeah.
And please, please call again and again. This has been the Counter-Racist Evolving Engineer Program for Thursday, January 26, 2012. See you next week in our Mind's Eye, signing out.
Shalom.